Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/GOT and using the GOT promo code. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 6, Episode 8, titled No One. You've seen it a couple times at least now, I presume.
Yes.
What is your opinion after the rewatches?
Well, I've come to a deeper appreciation for some of the Jaime stuff. But honestly, after reading hundreds of takes on this thing, I find myself more angry about the way Arya thing that went down. Now, there's some people to put a defense for the Arya stuff.
And it's all pretty pitiful.
I'm going to talk about that, and I want to give them. But I felt like that every one of the Arya defenders missed. There was no one that had an airtight defense of why this was good. And I suspect it's because, and this is a subjective opinion. You're free to feel free to disagree. But I suspect it's because it's just bad. And the worst part about it is it just seems like it's a self-inflicted gut shot.
Yep.
Like, no one made them stab the shit out of Arya. No, if we had gone from episode 206, Arya in her little black cell, and she has this complicated plot of luring the waif out to this place, that's fine. But, you know, there's so many different ways you could have done that and not have it be so kind of illogical. And it's even worse when I thought about. I'm not sure when we're going to dig into that particular piece of the plot, but
probably
got a lot to say about it.
I imagine at the end. It was a good week for Clegane's, though. Can I say that?
Well, unless you want them in bowls of various standings.
Right. But
hype.
I think it's a good week in general for Clegane's. They get a lot of action. They eat a lot of chickens.
They did.
You know, whatever it says about the future for the Clegane's.
But even still, is this cool if you eat 2/3 of all the chickens in the room?
He ate more chickens than he had any right to.
I feel like it was generous.
Yeah.
It was generous offing, but still. This is the guy who eats every chicken in the room. He settled for 2/3.
Right.
Not sure if I want to give him full credit for that. I'll give him 2/3 credit for being awesome.
Maybe it's the way that he ate the chickens that impressed me so much. Yeah.
And then there's other stuff. And then that's the thing. I'm trying to unpack my disappointment for some of perhaps the crazier theories that didn't seem so crazy in the last few weeks. And there's a couple that we haven't even talked about on the show that we'll have to save for the Friday spoiler edition. But man, it just, I don't know, I feel a little pissed upon.
Okay.
I feel like the Trident River just Sandor stood over me and wrote his name, wrote his name on me.
Yep.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, well, let's get into the recap.
What about you? You've been sitting there letting me stake out all these bold claims.
I largely agree. I think I maybe liked some of this episode a little more than you the first time around. It sounds like maybe if you've come to a greater appreciation of the Jamie and Brienne stuff, then maybe we're on the same page now. But yeah, I think the Arya stuff, while it doesn't really ruin her plot for me going forward, it does just completely fall down. Those scenes just... they didn't need to happen the way that they happened.
It came off like a stage fart.
It was real bad. It came off, honestly, in some ways worse than the Dorne stuff.
Because the Dorne stuff we didn't really... I guess we were interested only so much as it was a possible vengeance plot for Oberyn, who we liked, and also for the Lannisters, who we kind of don't like, against the Lannisters.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we didn't have any feelings one way or another about the Sand Snakes or Prince Doran or any of that before we got
it was
into
all new.
Whereas Arya, I know that they're not out there to be listened to, but I've been a huge fan of Arya's plot line since the first season. That was one of the, plots that kind of drew me in. It's not fatal. It's not like this show has been completely flawless in its plotting. You know, there was problems with Dany's and her dragons in season two, and there's a lot of perhaps gratuitous Theon torturing season three, and then we had the Dorne stuff, but I don't think this is fatal either, because we all knew that Arya was going to go back to the Westeros with a couple new tricks.
It's not like they put her in a bad position doesn't make a lot of sense with her trajectory. It's just the way it happened.
It's like when you think about for two seasons we've spent on this plot, that this is the best they could think of to put an end to that chapter, to close the door on this part of her voyage.
I can think of better ways to do this on the fly, that accomplish all the same goals.
Like you think about all the other sign-offs she's had, like when she was done with her training under Syrio, mm-hmm. That was pretty badass, and, her surviving on the mean streets of King's Landing. Arguably, doing a better job as a 7-year-old girl, or however old she was, just being traumatized over seeing her father beheaded than she did in Braavos with all this training.
Yeah.
You think about, when she got done to Jaqen the first time and Jaqen pulled his face off, and that was gave her to Iron Corn coin. That was cool. Iron Corn, that's something you get in Indiana. If you ever need the cobless men, you give him the Iron Corn.
Go see Jake. Jake in.
Yep, Jake and Rensselaer. He'll set you up. Then you think about, get done with the Hound. There's this big battle with Brienne, and Arya coldly kind of leaves him to die of his wounds.
Yeah.
This is by far the least satisfying development of that plot.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Other than her, headed back to Westeros, which I'm excited about.
Sure. I mean, even, when she was hiding out with Hot Pie and Gendry and I can't remember the guy, the recruiter for the Night's Watch. Even that was pretty cool. Yeah. The thing about crossbows is they take so long to reload. That was super memorable. This is... hell, we didn't even get to see her kill the Waif.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Okay.
Yeah, let's...
recap time.
Yeah.
So before we get into the recap, I've got a really cool promotional giveaway thing to tell you guys about.
Ah, yes.
We have teamed up with Factory Entertainment to do a giveaway for a lot of really cool Game of Thrones-related merchandise. They produce a lot of, plushes and prop replicas. That's hard to say.
All officially licensed, too.
Officially licensed, yeah, by, HBO and whatnot. They went ahead and sent us a bunch of these things, so we've had a chance to check them out, and we've actually got a mailbag video going up tomorrow, I think,
mm-hmm.
where we kind of show off a lot of the stuff. Plushes like Three-Eyed Raven and the Direwolf Cubs.
All the Direwolf Pups.
Yeah, all of them. So if you want to check that out, you can go to our website, baldmove.com, and look for that mailbag video. But it's a lot of really cool stuff, and they're just giving these things away for free for people who enter this contest. If you want to enter the contest to win a bunch of stuff, they're giving away those Direwolf Cub plush sets. plus some three-eyed ravens. They're giving away...
These things are adorable. They're about 8-9 inches tall, and they all are distinctive. Like, you know, Ghost looks like Ghost. Graywind looks like Graywind.
Right,
like
they're all colored.
But they're like the plush, puppy, super cute, very soft versions of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and they seem like they're good quality, too.
Yeah.
The stuff that's really cool and really good quality that they're also giving away is, like, the Winterfell desktop sculpture, which you can actually see if you're a club member in the background of Aeron's shot here. It's kind of way up at the top, but that's really cool. It's just they went and they analyzed all the frames of
Winterfell. It's a scale replica of Winterfell.
Right, and it's like 14 inches across. And
it's heavy.
Real big, and it's solid.
It's heavy. It's limited edition. They're all hand-numbered, and they got certificates of authenticity and, like...
Yeah, 1,500
cool facts about Winterfell.
Uh-huh. And then they're also giving away a Royal Crown of Baratheon and Lannister prop replica, where they got their hands on the actual crown that, you know, Tommen and Joffrey and I think Rob?
I think it's actually Joffrey's crown. It's because they're all three different.
Is it? They say Baratheon and Lannister.
Oh, well, I mean, that's because wink, wink. I think that's what they're trying to say there. But I believe particularly the one that Joffrey wore.
Okay, well, now that I have it in my hands, I have actually noticed that it does look like the one that Tommen is wearing.
Oh, really?
Currently.
I could be wrong.
But anyway, what they did is they got a hold of the actual crown that they use in Game of Thrones, and they were able to make a cast of that. Mm-hmm. And it's cast in metal, so like it's real heavy. It feels substantial.
It's gold plated. It's got replica, not real gems, but they look legit.
Sure.
It feels weighty when you put it on your head.
Yeah.
And it's got a badass display stand. It's essentially like four sword hilts that are propping it up, so you can kind of see it in all its glory.
So they're giving away one of those, which is really cool. And I've got that on my shelf behind me. The House Sigil Throw Pillow Collection, also apparently hard to say. There's six of those, and they have the symbols for all of the different houses, and then they're kind of slogans on the back.
The reverse
their
side,
words.
Yep.
Those are really cool. And then they're also giving away a George R.R. Martin talking plush, which it has like 10 different sayings that they have recorded from George R.R. Martin specifically for this thing. You can go to their website, factoryent.com, to check this thing out. Or just go to factoryent.baldmove.com, and it will take you right to the submission form to enter this contest. To win one of these awesome things, there's going to be one winner per item. And some of these things are worth a few hundred bucks. I mean, they've given away solid stuff here.
Yeah, they're like to the extent that a Game of Thrones prop replica can be heirloom, they're heirloom quality.
Yeah. For sure, they're collector's items. There's of the really nice stuff, there's only like 1,500 of them going to be made, limited edition run. So, yeah, if you want to check that out, do so at factoryent.baldmove.com. Also, they've given us a coupon code for 15% off all of their Game of Thrones merchandise. That coupon code is Drogon. So if you go there and decide you want to buy some of this stuff, maybe don't want to take your chances with just winning it, do both, enter and also buy some stuff.
If you want something you're not giving away, for example, a Hatchling Drogon plushie.
Right, which you've got on your microphone.
It's currently perched on my microphone.
The only thing that you can't use that code on is the crown prop replica, and also they do exclusive Game of Thrones giveaways for San Diego Comic-Con this year. So those aren't on the table, but everything else is for that Drogon coupon code. So check that out. I think it's really cool that they're giving away all this stuff.
Yeah.
Factoryent.baldmove.com. Lady Crane reenacts the Joffrey scene once again, and in this stage play she's performing in. She goes backstage. She finds an injured Arya hiding in the corner. So she takes her home, stitches up her wounds, and they talk for a bit about some fairly inconsequential stuff. And then
they talked a little bit about the writer's desperate attempt to make this make sense.
Right. Stabbed my boyfriend.
Yeah.
I'm a domestic abuser, and I practice my nursing skills.
They are coming home stinking of horrors. I'm not saying they don't deserve.
So they deserve to be stabbed.
But yeah, she's gotten pretty good as an amateur stitcher upper.
I guess so.
So. And here's the thing, I feel like already here we have to talk about how this plot is starting to veer off the rails, because Arya is going for assistance to a woman who's marked by death by the Faceless Men.
Mm-hmm.
Did she think in all her training the Faceless Men would be like, well, well, one of our assassins failed. I guess his contract's null and void? Did she really think that this is a safe place?
If so, she's real dumb.
Drinking the milk of the poppy, something that's going to put her in a coma, because some of the Arya defenders are like, well, you don't know how long she was unconscious with the milk of the poppy. It could have been a month. At which point I'm like, if it's a week or a month, then my thought is, if the waif shows up a day earlier or is slightly more quiet in her dispatching of Lady Crane, then Arya never wakes up.
Mm-hmm.
How the fuck is this a good plan? And Arya's even said, oh, I shouldn't drink this milk of poppy. It's going to knock me unconscious and I'm a wanted girl.
Yeah.
Well, you need your sleep. Okay, glug, glug, glug. I mean, come the fuck on. This makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. I don't know. And we know that not a lot of time passes because her stitches open back up once she does her little
parkour
stuff.
Yeah, it's a plot point that she's not fully healed.
Right, so it can't be a month. I mean,
but
well,
even if it was, that's such a phenomenally stupid idea to put yourself in a medical, a medically induced coma when you're being stalked by someone who's better than you at killing. You know,
I get the impression it was a few days at most.
I would guess it's a day or two or a few days.
It doesn't matter, really.
But again, you know, first thing to clean up if the other idea is, like, I guess, why is the waif still looking for Arya? Or was she even looking for Arya? I mean, she could have just been fulfilling Arya's contract, because I think the waif thought she'd kill her.
Yeah, but then she waits inside the house for Arya to come to the living room and check it out.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a good question, I guess, whether or not she knew she was there.
I think it's a valid reading, which makes it even stupider
of Arya
that the waif was just there to finish the contract. It's dangle that loose end and like, oh, what's this? Arya's in the bedroom? Twofer. Like,
well, it makes it stupid on Arya's part.
Yes.
Like, you should have known that.
Yes. Indeed.
Should have thought about it.
The mini face god needs a name, needs a face, and you're not providing it. What the hell?
Yeah. The other thing that puzzled me about this scene is when Arya is talking about the world of Planetos, I guess.
Yes.
And she says that nobody.
I think we established it.
Yeah.
Earth.
Future Earth.
Earth. As the maesters call it.
She says that nobody knows what's west of Westeros. Now, you would explain to me that wasn't true.
It's a continent of Westeros. Westeros.
Westerist? Westeristos.
Well, we don't know if it's Westerest. It's the most Westeros of the continents.
Sure.
Greater Westeros.
I thought people knew that. I thought...
No.
You would explain to me that they knew that the world was round.
They do know it's round, but they don't know what's lying to the easternmost, like what's on off the easternmost extent of Essos. So it's like they don't know whether it's kind of like an India situation. Do you sail, you know, west from Europe and do you hit India or do you smack into the Americas? Well, until you sail, you don't really know.
Right, but how did they... So they deduced from, like, horizon lines and orbits and shit that the world must be round?
I think, I mean, that's what people have told me. I don't have any direct knowledge because I have the world of Ice and Fire, but it's, like, crazy long, and I've read the parts that interest me, but I'm not... It's not... It's kind of like reading an encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's not designed to just, like, sit down and just read for pleasure. It's more like a research tome. But apparently there are things in there that says that the maesters understand that the world is round.
Okay. And I suppose Arya could not know that.
Like, but wait, she
looks at the maps and she says, well, that's all they show west.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, so I don't know. I mean, it seems like modern scholarship of Christopher Columbus says that not only did people know that the Earth was round at the time, but they also knew relatively how big it was. Now, no one knew that, except for maybe the Vikings, that the Americas lay in between Europe and India, but they knew that there was like a big, big, big voyage.
Okay.
So it's like, I think that like if she looks at the map, it could just be like a big blank spot where no one really knows. There could be a continent there. There could not be. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Plus, she left her home at 5 or 6 or 7 and probably didn't get that much educated on geography anyway.
Yeah. And she does specifically say, oh, the maps show this.
Sure.
So
here they be Krakens.
All right. Next scene, a couple of thugs who run with the guys who killed the Hounds group. teach some kid to kiss.
Yeah.
Then the Hound shows up and kills them all.
It's just a finger up your ass. That's the secret. Not only is this guy shit at kissing, he's shit at dying.
Yeah.
I did like that. I like the, it's like, really? Fuck you. That's the best you can do.
Sure. I was super excited to see this scene. I mean, the Hound rampaging. I love it. Love every second of it. And combined with, you know, the mountain rampaging later on.
Well, and they set it up with him chopping the wood. Like, you just knew how vicious and efficient he was at it. And, like, just him, you know, lumbering up from the background of that axe, it's like, oh, you know this is going to be good.
Right.
And then it was. So, yeah. That right, axe blow right to the nuts. And then...
Oh, yeah.
Then just everything that fell out. Like, I feel like,
brutal. It's a bad scene.
it's a great scene.
Right. I really loved watching it.
It's a horror show is what it was.
I don't know how much more you want to say about that.
I think that's about it.
Okay. So we go to Tyrion and Varys. They're walking through Meereen and they see a red priest singing Dany's praises to the people, saying she's sent by the red god. And Tyrion gloats over his success, how his plan is working perfectly.
It does seem like it is at this point. Like, yeah, Meereen has come back to life, as he says.
Yeah, Varys is a little more skeptical, though. He's like, don't count your chickens before the Hound comes to the room.
Yeah.
And then he sees Varys off on some expedition that he's going on.
Yeah. I surmised he's going to Westeros for some unknown purposes.
Okay.
Do you think... So the other thing I wanted, you know, since it's going to be hard for me to pick up things to just appraise the show for, I was struck the second time I was watching this just by how cool it was, the scene of Tyrion standing. Like, I guess we should feel lucky that there is a character or there's a guy like Peter Dinklage or just happens to be around this very accomplished thespian dwarf that can fully embody this guy.
Yeah.
This very complicated and awesome character of Tyrion Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is kind of amazing. And he looks awesome. And I just got this, like, just wave of pleasure. Like, that is exact. I mean, I know he's not exactly how he's described in the books. He's a lot more ugly and he's got his nose cut off and all that shit.
Mm-hmm.
But still, Hollywood it up to it. It's, I just want to take a moment to appreciate how awesome it is just to see that character.
Yeah, he's great. And I love this moment between him and Varys. I mean, you know, there's no cock jokes involved.
Nope.
There's no dwarf jokes. It's just, you know,
genuine affection.
Right, but not overtly expressed, just kind of implied, which I really like in those scenes.
I also think, because you talk about the cock jokes, I felt like there were some really missed opportunities. Like, I know you and I were thinking, oh, you put Varys and Tyrion together, and they're kind of in charge.
Yeah.
There's no king that you have to worry about offending. There's no other small council. Like, you can just... I guess I'm a little disappointed at the end of this particular part of the plot that we didn't get to see more crazy political maneuvering. Like,
yeah.
It's essentially have a state-sponsored church and make a desperate peace treaty with our enemies.
That backfires.
That backfires, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't have much success, I would say.
Kind of disappointing a little bit.
It's implied that maybe this Red Priest stuff is not going to go as he plans.
Well, I mean, that's...
The pact with the slavers already didn't go as he planned. I think he's failed pretty miserably.
Although I gotta say, I don't think that... I'm not willing to judge Tyrion too harshly on that, because it's not... If he didn't make the peace, then the Sons of Harpies continue tearing the city from within.
Uh-huh.
So, and who's to say? Like, Grey Worm seems like a competent commander, and he's got several thousand Unsullied in a very defensible position. Like, it's entirely possible that the attack would sputter out. Now, it would just devastate the city.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't... If Tyrion doesn't do that, then how does the game play out?
And I think they're very much...
Civil war within the city? Like, that's not good either.
Right. I do think he bought some time for Dany to get back,
and that
which
seems,
is important.
Yeah. So, like, I don't... So I guess that's the big question, is are they putting up this Red Priestess and Priest Gambit to be a debacle on the order of the Harpies coming to reclaim their property? Or are we to understand that Tyrion bought the time needed for Dany to come back and put an end to all this?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's supposed to be somewhat negative for Tyrion's
well, that's
skills,
what Grey, I mean, that, but that we think that because that's what Grey Worm and Missandei are saying. Like, I told you so. This is exactly what's going to happen. But
and Varys, I mean, Varys doesn't trust the Red Priest. True. Like, I think Varys is a good indicator of, you know, it's not a terrible plan, but it's not as firm as Tyrion thinks it is.
Had a few dozen people email me with the idea that it's highly suspicious that Varys gets the fuck out of Dodge right before the ships start raining fire upon the city.
It is.
Is Varys up to... I mean, we've always wondered. Know. Is Varys really for the realm? And if he is for the realm, is this part of his long con?
It's a good question. I couldn't tell you for sure.
Yeah, I feel
but
like...
it is awfully convenient.
I feel like you have to acknowledge that that is a little bit of the bald eunuch in the room.
Right.
At the timing, if Littlefinger did that, we'd be like, oh my god.
Yeah.
Cut to him on the boat twirling the mustache. Like, Varys, you know, he's got no hair. So he's got no mustache to twirl.
It's true, and he's never had to shave, apparently.
No. Well, so, I guess that's a part...
That's a time saver.
That's one of the good things about having your testicles forcibly removed when you're a boy. You just never develop the testosterone necessary to grow hair.
Yeah, he never really looks on the bright side of it.
Yeah.
That Varys. He's kind of a negative Nancy.
Always talking about the demonology you use with your dick, you know? Yeah. Come on.
All right, Qyburn tells Cersei that the Faith Militant are here, and she goes out to meet them. They tell her that the High Septon has commanded her to meet him in the Sept, and she refuses. And when... once one of Lancel's guys tries to, you know, coerce Cersei to come by putting an axe in the mountain's chest, the mountain rips his head off.
Literally
rips his head off. Nothing but his bare hands. And then the other Faith Militant don't really press their luck on this issue. They kind of retreat.
And was it Brian Cogman that directed? I think he did direct his last two. If not, forgive me. It's one of the other regulars. But
I think it's Mark My.
Oh, Malad. That's right, Malad. Pardon me, Mark. I love the way he filmed this, like from unconventional angles. Like we got the gutter cam of the blood running down, and the mountains slowly rising from the wreckage of this guy's corpse. Pretty good. Like
And the finger twitching in the blood pool.
Yeah,
like it really impressed upon you that Lancel and his guys don't want any part of this.
I kind of wish
it's a bad scene.
If I had any expectation to be that the mountain would kill everyone except maybe Lancel to send the message. But ripping the dude's head off was pretty cool.
That sent a message.
Yeah, definitely.
And also the mountain doesn't have really any will, right? He doesn't want to go in there and kill everybody. He's just doing what he needs to do to stop people from killing Cersei. So,
I mean, that's
like
an assumption, but it seems like a safe one. Like we tried to pin down exactly what the mountain can and can't do, and what kind of thought processes and I mean, like what does he see and think about?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me he was just trying to stop the violence against Cersei here. And that was literally the only thing he cared about.
Like, if you look out through the mountain's eyes, do you see essentially T-800 vision? Only it's like in medieval script. You know?
Right, yeah. It's got some Skyrim language there.
Yeah, so. Exactly. It says runes.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, let's move on to Brienne and Podrick. They show up at River Run, and there's a few scenes here, one with Podrick and Bronn. Bronn's pestering him and speculating about whether Jaime and Brienne are fucking, and then he decides to teach Podrick how to fight dirty. This is a really good scene. It's just a lot of fun.
Did you think it was interesting that Jaime, just the previous episode, berated DeFreys for not having effective scouts that allowed an army of 8,000 to march without being challenged, and Brienne and Pod get within sight, within 3 football fields of Jaime's camp before his outriders come up and say, "Who goes there?" Like,
no, I thought they were effectively doing what they were supposed to do.
I don't know. The fact that you got within sight of the camp is because that's not effective enough warning. If, say, there was like 4,000 people here coming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just...
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think that was the show's version of this is an effective scouting and Jaime knows what he's doing. But to me, I'm like, there's not much difference between letting someone ride into your camp and letting them ride within 300 feet of your camp.
I imagine if it was an army of 4,000 people, they wouldn't have.
Maybe. That's true. Maybe they've been watching the whole time and just challenged them when, you know,
when they realized they were headed toward them.
Yeah. They was just 2 people.
Yeah.
Nitpick no threat. Withdrawn.
Okay.
You got me.
But it is funny how, you know, Podrick identifies this as a siege. And you know, it looks like a siege now. And yeah. Bran's like, well, no shit.
Yeah, right. Do tell.
Yeah.
It's funny that Jaime does seem like he's allowing the phrase to have the primacy, though. Like, I noticed that the closest encircling is still the phrase pitiful mud tents.
That's not a bad idea.
I guess not, yeah.
Like, you know, our forces, we'll just hang back a little bit.
Sure,
we'll tell
true.
You how to set up so when the fighting starts,
that's
you lose
true.
Your guys.
When they start shooting the flaming arrows and shit, it's going to be your... Yeah. Yeah, that's wow.
So maybe he's doing the smart thing there. Doesn't want to lose his own guys.
Keen military mind you have there, Jim.
Right? Yeah, I need to be Brienne's squire, I guess.
Would you fuck her?
I'd at least show her my dick.
You know, not like overtly, but
no.
Just kind of like, oh, you caught me peeing, my lady. I'm sorry.
Right.
Didn't know you were there.
I feel like I'm not doing my job if everyone hasn't seen my dick. All right, let's move on to Brienne and Jaime, because they're by far the most important part of this. Brienne asked Jaime to try and let her persuade the Blackfish to surrender the castle and go up and help Sansa instead. And Jaime agrees, and Brienne tries to give his sword back, but he says, don't want it. It's yours now. It will always be yours. And before leaving, she tells Jaime that, look, if I can't persuade the Blackfish to surrender, I'm going to have to fight against you. I'm honor bound. So I guess it's good that it didn't go down that way.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. There's a lot of cool things here. The fact that Jaime's word means something to Brienne, but it means literally nothing to everyone else.
Right.
Like, to both Edmure and the Blackfish, they both are very skeptical about this guy's
word.
It's
less than nothing. It's like they scoff at it, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh
your word.
The Kingslayer's giving me his word, the Oathbreaker. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Great. I mean, yeah, it's hard to come back from. You have an oath to protect the king. That's your one job.
Yeah.
And even if you have good reason, it's like, you know, I'm sure you'll have a good reason to betray me in the future as well.
Right.
But I like that they're doing this thing with Jaime too, where, you know, Jaime's back to not really truly knowing who he is. Hmm. Like, he's like, okay, I want to be like my dad. I want to be like Tywin Lannister. And I love my sister, and my sister says I need to lead, so I'm going to try to remember what it was like, what my dad was like, and see what he would do in this situation. Oh, but here's Brienne, and I forgot about her. She's the example of like knights that are actually chivalrous and honorable, and they keep their word. And like, I can't believe she's still alive.
Right.
And she completed her mission. Like, maybe there is something to this shit. He's really torn between the both truths. Like, he mm-hmm. wants to aspire to be this knight. That's the kind of knight that he trained under and he aspired to be, but he also loves his sister, and his sister's kind of a terrible person, and his family's kind of terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, she's like, not great.
I got quite a bit of feedback of people decrying the kind of, like, backwards character development of Jaime, but I feel like this is just, you know, he's changing as the situations and as his environment, and it's natural. It's like, it's, you know, it's like those foxhole conversions or deathbed conversions. If you miraculously survive that event, when he gets his arm chopped off and he's laid low, and then despite all odds, he's got his golden hand, and now he's wearing all his fine Lannister armor. I feel it's believable that you would kind of forget some of the promises and high-minded ideals you had when you're at your darkest hour.
Yeah, sure. I could see that. It's also, I like the symbolism of the sword here, right? It's not just a sword to him. Yeah. It's like, it's almost a piece of himself that he's given to Brienne.
And he called it Oathkeeper. He rejects it. I think that's very symbolic too. Like, it's not just that he wants Brienne to have it, but, you know, this thing is symbolic of oaths and things that knights should take seriously.
Right.
And he knows in his heart of hearts that he's not ready to do that, or he
can't. And Brienne is.
So,
and
like,
has, yeah.
Yeah, like, I can't accept this because it's not, doesn't match up with who I am.
Right. Then we get a scene of Brienne trying to convince the Blackfish to surrender. And, you know, there's kind of this drawn out argument, and like, the Blackfish is very stubborn about it, and though he believes her story after she shows him the letter from Sansa, and he's like, oh, she's just like Catelyn.
Yeah.
He still refuses. And then Brienne tells Podrick to send Sansa a letter stating that I failed.
Sure, because he did.
Yeah, that's a shame. You know, I hate to see Brienne failing in her mission.
But, yeah.
It seemed like the only outcome for this. I couldn't imagine the Blackfish actually surrendering. He's just such a stubborn guy.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, on the other hand, it feels weird narratively that he dies for precisely nothing. Like, once Edmure was let back into the castle and he was clear he's going to surrender, like, I get, like, wanting to stay true to your school until then, but once that, and, like, you literally are going to spend the rest of your life as a hostage in this war, or you can ride north and whatever help you can give, even as a recruiting tool, like the fact that the Blackfish is standing by your side and maybe you can recruit from the Riverlands, like that's a little bit more legitimacy. It's kind of puzzling to me. I get he's a stubborn old bastard.
Yeah.
But it does seem pretty short-sighted, and maybe that's the thing with him. Like, he is one of those Ned Stark types, or honor and especially martial honor is worth more than anything. And
right.
You know, Ned compromised because he wanted to keep his daughter safe. He's not ready to compromise to keep someone else's daughter safe.
Right. And I, you know, unlike the Arya stuff, I don't feel like this mistake that he makes here of staying is a problem.
No.
Because it is very true to what we've seen of him as a character.
It's not a false character moment. It's more of like, God, why did you, just like Ned, you know, why did you have to do the things you had to do?
Right.
But you do, because, you know, that's who you are.
And he makes a good point. You know, that Sansa is trying to take her home back, and he understands that, and that's exactly why he won't leave here.
Right.
And go help her, because this is his home. So, I don't know. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, agreed.
His reasoning, even though it was a senseless death.
Agreed.
And then we go over to Cersei, and she's walking into the throne room for a royal announcement, and she tries to approach the throne to take her place by Tommen's side, but Kevin jumps in her way.
Oh, Kevin sliced her up a nice, nice heaping slice of condescension.
Oh, yeah.
Why wasn't
your place is in the gallery?
Well, it's like, she goes, like, because there's a royal announcement. Why wasn't I informed? There's a royal announcement.
Right.
It's happening right now.
You dick.
Like, oh, God, it's so good.
Yeah. The announcement...
And it makes sense, because I feel like Kevin was kind of on her and Jamie's side about this plan. Like, he believed in it. Now he doesn't have a son back. The High Septon has an even tighter grip on it. It's going like, you fucked it up again.
Yeah.
Against my better judgment, I backed your play, and that, like, I don't feel like it came from nothing.
Right.
And I like that he's, like, super dick to her, because it's like, look what you did.
And
look,
I get the impression that he thinks the city may be better off without her.
Oh, yeah.
At this point.
So, I actually agree with him.
Right. Yeah, I think these people don't need Cersei in charge of things.
But this was like essentially an abbreviated version of the speech that Lady Olenna gave it to him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that was the two people he conspired with, and they're both saying, you're shit. You're shit at this. Not going to even give you a chance to fuck up by no, get into the gallery with the rest of the...
Yeah.
Irrelevant women whose opinions don't matter in this feudal patriarchal society.
Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't mean to say, like, I think the city is better off under the Faith Militant or the High Septon.
But
I think
better off without Cersei.
Better off without Cersei. Just leave it at that.
Yep.
So the announcement starts off relatively benign. Hey, we're going to do this on the first day of Easter celebration.
He sure does have a boner about this Twin Pillars stuff, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, he's talking, like, about it a lot.
All the damn time.
The,
like, that's
the crown.
That's how he likes to start his speeches.
Yeah. Lynn's legitimacy, too. I'm sure the High Septon has been, like, in his ear, you know, okay, when you start your speeches,
yeah,
remember to mention the pillars.
Yeah,
do it.
The pillars is a crowd pleaser.
Really, they love it.
They
we've taken the polls. We have our guys out in the streets asking.
Yeah, the phallic imagery, the twin phallic, just really gets him going, man. Got to lead with the pillars. Always lead with the pillars.
So he does. He leads with the pillars and the date of the trial, but he also follows that up with the pronouncement that trial by combat is no longer a thing we do. It's just, we're done with that. That was the old, that was people wrongfully putting in place these procedures that are an abomination, essentially.
No man is so accursed as a hype slayer, Tommen.
Right.
You're doomed.
Tommen.
The thing is, like, the second time I watched this, I'm like, well, you're not wrong. This was a system put in place by the powerful to skirt ideas of justice and whatnot. But on the other hand, Clegane Bowl, man.
Right.
What the fuck?
Yeah, he's certainly slaying the hype.
Do you think, and I know this is a, we'll be talking more about this in the feedback section, but do you think the Clegane Bowl is well and truly dead? Or do you think that the Hound and the Mountain are going to meet, but just not fighting for Cersei's honor?
I think it's still, you know, it's as live as the Hound was after he fell off that cliff.
Okay.
It's looking bad.
Yeah. It's got,
and, you
a
know,
femur
it might
shooting
rest
up through
for
his
a little
shoulders.
While,
yeah.
But it might come back.
Okay.
Yeah, but I certainly think not in... I don't think Cersei is going to talk to Tommen and get him to reverse this decision. I think that the trial by combat is dead. It's always kind of been a silly thing anyway in my mind.
Yeah, that's true.
An awesome thing, but a silly thing.
And also, it's kind of, it would feel like a Death Star too, right? Like, oh, well, I guess this is cool, but man, is it going to be cooler than Oberyn versus the Mountain?
Right.
So maybe it's better. It's all for the best that if it's going to happen, it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
that way.
I'm starting to really, really dislike Tommen. He's just so weak and so foolish.
Yeah.
And I just, like, as much as, you know...
And it makes sense.
Joffrey was hated, and
sure.
I... Trust me, I hate Joffrey way more than I hate Tommen. I just think... I wish Tommen would grow a pair and just fucking not let everybody chattering in his ear influence all his decisions.
He's 14.
I know. It sucks.
Yeah.
This is why kid rulers don't make sense.
Sure.
And when you combine it with Lady Mormont last episode, I don't know what to think.
Yeah, well, you know, he should have been raised as a fucking bear.
I guess so.
Not a lion.
The other thing in the scene, I mean, this is such a serious betrayal by Tommen, because especially when paired with the speech that Jaime gives to Edmure later about how Cersei would do anything for her children, and we know that's her major concern all along, her safety too.
I still haven't backed down from what I said in the instant cast. That I do feel like that there is, because I don't think Kevin hates Cersei, but he doesn't want to see her dead.
Okay,
so it wouldn't surprise me if we find out that Tommen essentially is saying, you know, she's got the mountain, which means she'll avoid all justice. And my mom does need to be brought down a peg or two or three. So, like I said, he looked guilty, but not like, I've killed my mom, I signed my mom's death warrant guilt. Now, that could be that this is just going to be another, you know, some more fuckery about a High Septon, and he does try to have Cersei executed. I don't know.
I feel like he's going to try to kill her.
Why? Because Cersei, I mean, here's the thing that I resist this. Because do you think the High Septon, do you think the High Sparrow is a smart, astute political person?
Mm-hmm.
At least as smart as Lady Olenna. It seems like that he when he challenged her last season, kind of proclaimed himself her equal, and then he beat her. Lady Olenna is able to correctly assess Cersei's situation, which is you have no power. You have nothing. Right. You have nothing but this fucking mountain. I think the High Sparrow knows that, and after the guy's head got ripped off, he's like, you know what? I'm just going to completely alienate her from everyone and just let her be irrelevant.
I mean, I suppose
probably so. A dangerous move, but I think that's what he's thinking.
Well, okay, so I think the biggest things that he needs to be afraid of, the biggest thing is other people's influence over Tommen, who really is his only piece in this chess game,
right?
That has any power. So if Margaery can convince Tommen to go against him, if Cersei can convince Tommen to go against him,
yeah,
that's the only way he loses this game.
I guess that's so true as well.
But it is you know, a tightrope where if he kills Cersei, he might lose Tommen.
Exactly.
He probably would lose Tommen.
That's what I'm saying. I guess like the safe play is to just really kick her while she's down and make sure she stays there.
Yeah.
But not kill her, which might turn Tommen against him.
Okay, I can see that. That does seem like the smart thing.
Yeah.
And you know, it really, ringing in my ears, and I hope in Cersei's ears here, are the advice that Olenna gave her last episode, which is get the fuck out of here.
Sure.
If you're smart, you'll leave. You have no power. And she didn't. And now she's kind of fucked. I mean, yeah. She can't leave now.
Yeah.
I mean, unless she can, you know, fight her way to a boat with the mountain and just get out of the city.
Yeah.
But I don't see that happening.
No. Well, yeah. Yeah, I don't either.
Like, I can imagine the Faith Militant are everywhere.
I guess I kind of... That's the one thing I like about the dismissal of the popular theory of the Clegane Bowl is that I do feel like, for the first time in several episodes, where I really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, King's Landing is a real question mark for me right now. There's a lot of people with ideas and theories, but it seems like, you know, they're back to, oh, I'm back to the just enjoyment of watching a show and see what happens.
Okay, cool. There is that final part of this scene where Qyburn tells Cersei that he has investigated this rumor she heard about and that there's more to it. In fact, there's much more to it.
Yeah.
I talked about on the instant cast how I think this is Wildfire.
I think you're right.
Because of some of the visions that we saw from Bran.
And the old rumor, and some people dug up some quotes from Jaime from the previous season that maybe seems to match up with this, and when she says there's an old rumor or something more, and he goes, oh, more, much more. That definitely doesn't seem like it applies to Tyrion. It seems like it applies to a quantity of something.
Yeah.
And if you with the old rumor and kind of...
I suppose you could say, oh, it goes deeper. It goes much deeper.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and,
maybe...
But with the wildfire vision, I think you're right. I think you're right. And there's several suggestions in the feedback about how that might... How about that come to play?
I want to go with my own, but I don't want to serve up too much dry pie.
Nah, do it. Do it.
Bad Baker Jim is going to serve up some pie.
the
driest of pie. So I think what's going to happen is during her trial, she might actually try to sacrifice herself to take out all of these, the Septon and all of his dudes, Faith Militant, by burning the Sept.
Yeah.
And that might get away from her. Like, oh, there's much more wildfire than we thought. Oops, we burnt it all.
Well, there's also this conspicuous mention of the king in chambers praying.
Like, oh, right, yeah.
It could be that she thinks that Tommen is somewhere safe.
And he's actually
at the Sept and praying. Yeah. And it'd be really... I can just really see a knife-twisting moment where you find out, like, from his POV, Tommen is actually praying for his mother's deliverance.
Uh-huh.
And then the green fire, whoosh, it's like, yeah.
And then, yeah, right, she'll accidentally kill him. I don't know how the little brother stuff comes into this prophecy, but like...
Right.
You know, the witch tells her that all three of her kids are going to die before, and then she's going to as well. So maybe, like, they both die in that scene. And then that's That's a fulfillment of the prophecy, and it's also brutal for Jaime because he's out doing something that he that Cersei sent him to do,
sure,
to get back to her again, uh-huh, once again, and she's not there when he gets back. She's dead, and yeah, she's dead probably because he left her.
Right.
Like, that'd be pretty gut-wrenching for him.
Yeah, it definitely put Game of Thrones back to its track of lots of big deaths and emotional weight to them.
Yeah.
And just kind of how fucked up that whole situation is.
Yeah, so that's so, my best guess.
I think that's a good sketch of probably what's going to happen.
Okay. Let's move on to Tyrion pouring Grey Worm and Missandei some wine and telling some jokes. He toasts the queen and forces them to drink, then starts in on his jokes, which gets Missandei into the spirit, you know, both with the wine and the jokes. And she tells a joke, and even by the end of it, Grey Worm joins in. And eventually they're interrupted by bells signaling the arrival of an enemy fleet.
I did enjoy, this was pointed out on Reddit, that Tyrion never can tell the story of the honeycomb and a jackass. Did
yeah,
you see that?
I did.
I forgot this, but in season one, when he's kind of stalling before Lysa's court, he starts telling this story, and she says, "Silence, enough," or whatever, right as he gets right to this point. So it's like he's just never going to be able to tell the honeycomb and a jackass and what they're doing in the brothel.
Yeah.
I'd like this scene more the second time through because, and almost solely because, there's this moment where he's making them drink, which is whatever, but then he talks about how when he goes back to Westeros, he'd like to have his own vineyard. And it's Imp's Delight, which, what's the odds that HBO is going to have an officially licensed Imp's Delight before next season?
Yeah, they already have licensed beers.
I know.
Why not just go license
the Om
wines?
Gang, yeah.
Yeah.
I know. There's a couple people emailed. It's like, I don't, it's like this product placement doesn't sit well with us, but it's like,
I don't care.
Whatever.
Right.
I would buy a $20 bottle of Imp's Delight.
I also Why believe not? That Tyrion would want a vineyard. Like,
sure.
He's dedicated himself to wine pretty thoroughly already.
They're talking about product in-universe product placement is a little gauche, I guess is what they're trying to say.
Right. I mean, it's not like he's drinking a Pepsi, right? This is right, like within character, too.
And by the way, have I told you about Casper Bitten? So yeah, I'm not one to talk about product placement advertising.
Sure.
But I do think, yes, I think it's one of those things where it's like it's not like you know, Spock hawking his symbol of infinite diversity thing in the original Star Wars just out of nowhere and like buy this trinket. It's like, yeah, Game of Thrones fans probably like to drink wine. Tyrion likes to drink wine. This is something consistent with his character. And also, to get to the point I really wanted to make, I thought when he's going into this revelry and he's like, only my close friends can drink it. And then it like really sobers him up because he's like, shit.
Yeah.
My closest friend is probably Braun, and he don't like me that way. Like, it's a pure, like, I think he's like, my closest friends might be these two people in the room who are essentially robots that I'm forcing to drink with me.
Yeah.
Like, that was a really sobering thing that I don't have anybody. I've got this vineyard.
I count maybe four
friends.
I could see Braun as a friend. I could see Varys as a friend.
Yeah, I guess Varys.
But yeah, then Grey Worm and Missandei, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to make much wine,
yeah,
although he drinks a lot.
I hope him and Jaime reconcile.
Yeah.
Maybe over a glass of Imp's Delight.
That'd be great.
But that's what worked me, because the jokes are like, you know, whatever. I guess it was fun to see Missandei and Grey Worm kind of loosen up and Grey Worm trying to tell his not-joke.
Yeah.
But it's the emotional point of him just realizing, oh, God, my life is really depressing. And yeah. I've kind of hidden behind... I've been in a wine-soaked haze to try to shield myself from this reality, and it's just, oh, damn it, it just creeped in on the edges. I don't like it. That's pretty good. Pretty subtle performance, too.
Yeah, and I do like Grey Worm kind of seeing how much Missandei is enjoying this, and he likes seeing her laughing, and his jokes and the wine are making her happy and therefore making him happy.
Yes.
They're doing a little bit of connective stuff here.
Yep.
With a relationship that I didn't really buy last season. So.
Yeah. And like I said, I liked the first time they did this, I bitched about it, but then I liked it when I thought of, you know, a couple of listeners pointed out that this is consistent with how he tries to break the ice. Like, that's how he rolled with Braun and Shay, and now he's trying to replicate that with these people, and it's not working, but that's kind of his go-to. So,
yeah.
I gotta show grudging respect for this part of the plot.
Okay. Then we go to Jaime trying to convince Edmure to help end the siege by convincing the Blackfish to surrender. He refuses, of course, and then Jaime explains that he needs to end this siege to get back to Cersei because he loves her like she loves her children, and of course, like Catelyn loved her children, and that he'll kill absolutely everyone to do so, and that convinces him. We'll talk about that in a second. Yeah, this is a great scene.
I like the structure of it, of essentially Edmure playing the part of the audience, where it's like, get to the fucking point, and Jaime's like, no.
You're my prisoner.
I'm building to my point, and it's going to be more the awesome for it. Because you get, you know, Jaime's been genteel, and he's saying, like, hey, I'll feed and clothe you, and maybe you and your kid can... He did offer him, like, some kind of parole at Casterly Rock, didn't he? Was that what he offered him?
That's a good question.
I thought he's trying to play this, like, carrot. And Edmure just wasn't taking it. So then Jaime just slowly rounded in to, and this just goes back to him telling the phrase, only a fool makes a threat that he's not prepared to carry out. Mm-hmm. So when he fully levels with Edmure and says, I'm going to send for your baby boy, and I'm going to launch him over to castle walls, and I'll kill every single fucking member of your family until you're all dead, if that's what it takes to get back to my sister.
Yeah.
It really sold the moment. And it's also the duality of Jaime. He's this vicious, but the Brienne is his wistful longing that he didn't have to be, or maybe he doesn't, and this is just a cycle he's trapped in. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I take him seriously during this speech.
I think you're a fool if you don't.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. And also the fact when he says the things we do for love, the last time he said this, he threw an 8-year-old out of a castle window.
Right.
So, like, I think that's an extra, like, if you're a Jaime fan, which I count myself among, and a lot of people try to make a lot of excuses for Jaime's behavior, and he's a pitiable character. Like, you can empathize with him. But this is just a reminder that this is the same Jaime that does shit like that.
Yeah.
That this is not bluffing, and, oh, well, we'll go to a different plan if Edmure stands strong. No, this is something that he will carry out, this plot. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was excellent, and it really... You know, and it also, you know, just a lot of people saying, oh, the you know, Edmure's like bitched out and all this and that is like, you know, when he goes back to the castle, he surrenders. But, you know, you think about it in terms of like Lord Glover's speech from last episode about how the, you know, the Starks, like he supported the Starks and he was true blue and he's ready to die for him. And now since everything's happened, he's like really regretted that decision. Edmure might be the right kind of lord. Like, if you're his bannerman, would you rather him take this kind of peace with dignity, or would you rather fight a doomed, scorched earth that's going to probably get you all killed and this house decimated?
Like, will. I mean, I...
Like, Edmure, he chills for 15, 20 years. What's the odds that he can't rally the... Like, the Freys are going to... Like, especially after, like, you know, Walder Frey dies. Mm-hmm. Everything's up for grabs again. Like, if I wait and bide my... It's like, what's the odds that the Freys are going to fuck things up? Pretty high, especially once old Walder dies and it's just a bunch of idiot sons. Mm-hmm. Like that's a smart play. The Blackfish is the one that's stupid, and yet...
Right.
You know, the audience is conditioned to believe the Blackfish is the one that's, you know, valiant and true, but...
Right. It's maybe more noble to kind of fight to the death, but it's foolish
just,
as well.
Just like Jorah said about Rhaegar. Yeah, he was noble, and he fought bravely, and he died.
Right.
Where guys like Varys and Littlefinger are the survivors. So I actually came to greater appreciation of Edmure's, not just his personal stakes, but his capability as a lord.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it feels like that he's a better lord than a lot of these other ones we root for.
Yeah.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
So Jamie's speech obviously does convince him to end the siege. He goes up to the gate, he demands entry, and over the Blackfish protestations, they let him in because turns out he's the rightful lord of Riverrun. Edmure then immediately surrenders the castle to Jamie and demands that the Blackfish is handed over to the Freys. Blackfish sees Brienne and Pod off in a boat, but stays behind to fight to the death. Then Jamie finds out that the Blackfish died fighting and waves to Brienne as she leaves down the river.
Yeah, I wonder this guy, his Castilian, the head of the defense of Riverrun, he seems like he's really bummed out that they're just laying down their arms, but you think in 5 years, will he be the anti-Glover? It's like, you know what? I thought he was crazy when he did this, and it was a bitter pill to swallow to let those Freys into our, and the Lannisters into our home, but... You know, now we're laying siege to the twins and look aware thing. You know, it's like you just right. never know.
And does this do anything? Is Jamie kind of on a road to recovering his reputation a bit by actually keeping his word here?
I don't. That's a good. That's a good.
At least in his mind. Like, I don't want to say, oh, yeah, in the world, he's definitely becoming known as someone who keeps his oath.
He didn't. Yeah, it's weird that, like, I will send your firstborn over these walls. But, yeah, like, he didn't lie or beguile or anything. He said, these are the terms, and if you're not going to accept them, then now here's what's going to happen. You might be onto something.
Maybe in his own head, he's like, I'm going to do something here that restores my reputation a bit.
A bit.
That starts that road, you know, that path.
But where is he going? Is he going towards the root of Tywin, or is he going to something better?
Right. Does he just want to earn back his house say, or, you know, his family saying Lannisters always pay their debts?
Yep.
I don't know. He's still got a lot of work to do there with Bronn in that category.
Yeah, and it's we'll a pretty chilling scene where you see all the. You know, the Lannisters goose stepping into the River Run and all the River Run guys piling up their arms and armor and big, and it's...
And they show what idiots the Freys are here, because he's like, oh, if you're wrong, you've surrendered our most valuable...
I was hoping Jamie's already... giving him another black eye, because, yeah, like,
well,
really?
I'm glad he doesn't even dignify it with a response, because this guy's an idiot. Like, you've already played that card, it didn't work... Now we're playing my game. Like, this is the only move we have. That prisoner means nothing.
If it doesn't work, then we're going to do what we were going to do anyway, which
exactly.
is, you know, pill every last of these guys out and kill them. So,
yeah.
It is a bummer that Blackfish dies in an entirely futile gesture. I guess that's the big bummer. It was just for no good end.
It's his own honor,
and we
I guess.
Didn't even get to see, like, an... like, it wasn't even awesome in the way, like, Barristan Selmy went out. It was just...
Yeah.
I'm going to fight these guys. I haven't fought in a long time. I'm old. I'll probably cock it up. And I guess he did.
I guess so. Yeah, it doesn't sound like there would have been much to see anyway.
Yeah.
Would have been a guy getting run through.
Yeah, it's a bummer, though. It's a bummer.
Yeah. I can't help but think how much Edmure looks just like Luke Wilson, too. Like,
really?
Oh, my God.
I guess
his face
bit.
In certain shots looks just like him.
I thought that the Blackfish and Edmure showed a very strong familial... resemblance.
Yeah,
I was kind of amazed. It was like, wow, the casting people did a really good job, and that you could definitely see that they're related, even though they're not.
So Marine is under attack from the boats. They're firing flaming shit over the walls. Looks like some sort of explosive. Grey Worm shuts down Tyrion's plan to mount the defense on the beach, instead favoring defense at the pyramid, which is probably smart.
Yeah.
And the pyramid begins to shake.
Yeah, as they're literally being rained hellfire down. Like, really? You think it's a good idea to form up on the beach?
Yeah.
To abandon our easily fortifiable... Yeah, well, you know, Tyrion's he's a shit military guy.
I guess so. But the pyramid starts to shake just as they say that, and then they prepare for battle. But instead, Dany walks in from the balcony as Drogon flies off in the background.
Yep.
Now, Dany walks in, and everybody's surprised and reassured, but they're not out of the woods by a long shot here. I mean,
aren't
Drogon flies off as near I can tell.
Yeah, but she could be like whistle him and he comes right back, and also where the other two dragons, and there's 100,000 Dothraki that they got now that can just...
No. Those Dothraki didn't fly in with her. They have a weak
what I'm
walk.
Saying is they're coming. And like,
they're coming, yeah.
Like, there's no way they can take the city and hold it. Like, I just
they can't
feel like,
hold it, sure.
I don't know. I just feel like it's a done deal. You're going to... And I'm kind of surprised we didn't see it in this episode. Just ships on fire and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible the Drogon is not leaving.
It was
He's
a cool...
It
was a cool reveal, and I'm glad to see Dany's back. On the other hand, I know it could have been cooler. You know, I guess I'm greedy.
It certainly could have, yeah.
I guess I'm greedy.
And it might still. I mean,
yeah.
There's plenty of opportunity next episode for the dragon to light some shit on fire.
But I feel like that, well, I mean, unless they're going to give us, yes, like a really intense battle for Barine, which I don't believe.
Right.
Then I guess I would have liked to seen her strafing. Like, I want to see Dany riding Drogon's back and him doing something cool. Like, he's just essentially an evacuation helicopter for her at this point. Like, I want to see him become a gunship, goddammit.
You might have to wait for Westeros for that.
Yeah.
Assuming she gets there anytime. Anytime at all.
Maybe she wants to sail to Westeros and try her hand at Queen there before she goes west. You know, just really bracket Westeros. Go east, go west. Now I'm ready to go, right up the middle.
All right, so we go back over to the Hound. He comes across the Brotherhood Without Banners, who are preparing to execute the three guys who killed his group. He wants to kill them instead, but the Brotherhood also wants to. There's this battle over who gets to kill who.
And they want
to
do it the right way. We're not butchers.
Right. Not with the axe, with the rope. The Hound ends up getting to hang two of the three, and he takes the boots of the yellow-cloaked one.
That was so grimly funny that the man's still kicking. Like, his feet are still twitching, and, like, what is that like for if you're Lemon Cloak?
Yeah.
You're dying, and you're kind of, like, desperate to get out of it towards the end, and, like, you're dying, and you become aware the guy who's just killed you is stealing your boots.
Yeah.
That's got to be the worst way to die.
Really insulting.
Yeah.
So then the Hound sits down to eat with him, and they convince him to join up with them to fight the Northern Winds.
Do they convince him, or do they make the argument, and we're kind of left to wonder what he's going to make of it?
He doesn't say no.
But he has a lot of cogent arguments. It's like, the Lord of Light didn't spare me. I'm just better than you. I beat you because I'm better than you. And I'm still, if you hadn't tried that trick with the fire sword, it wouldn't even been close. And I'm better than you now, and I could beat you. I thought that was all good. I also liked the humor. It was very appreciated, like his just gruff, put that down, little girl. Tougher girls than you have tried to kill me, which is a nice reference to both Brienne and Arya. It's like there's no punishment. He's like, well, they'll die. It's like, we all die except for this one here. I thought that was all good,
and his line about preferring chickens was pretty good.
Yep,
like that.
Yep.
Not crazy
about the two-thirds chicken, but why? I guess I don't understand why the Brotherhood doesn't let him kill all three. Like, I get, like, not being able to butcher them seems like a pretty good concession, and they're getting hung anyway, so why not let Sandor, the one who was most aggrieved? Like, it's your reputation, right. It's his friends. Like, come on, Dondarrion, what the fuck is your problem?
Yeah, and I mean, the Brotherhood also kind of killed them. I mean, they caught them.
Yeah, they caught them, they strung them up. He just kicked the stump from out. But I felt like it was way more of a one-sided deal than they're kind of alluding to in the show.
Yeah, I mostly agree. He stops putting up a fight by the end of this discussion. So, to me, I think he's all but joined them.
And he's
we'll
looking
see how
for
it goes.
A purpose, sure, yeah.
Right, and he's... Yeah, and they kind of say the same thing that... The seven-pointed star guy did, whose name I can't think of right now.
I think it's Maribald. In the books is Maribald, but I believe in the show is Roy.
Okay. They kind of tell him the exact same thing, right?
Yeah.
In that scene. So I think that strikes a nerve with him.
I think it's interesting that the brother of that Banners is aware of what's going on north, too.
Yeah.
That is a new thought to me.
Right. And I don't know what part the Hound might have to play in that fight, but
sure.
It's interesting. So the Waif shows up at Lady Crane's house and kills her. And Arya is confronted by Waif, ends up jumping off the balcony, and then Waif gives chase through the streets. Arya manages to make it back to her hidey hole, and Waif follows. Then Arya grabs Needle and cuts the lights. And then we go over to the hall, black and white. Jaqen finds Waif's face on the wall, and Arya standing by. She says she's going home. And Jaqen kind of looks happy to hear it, a little proud. A lot to talk about in this scene, I guess.
The first thing before... I want to say a couple things. Number one, stunt-wise, this was admittedly a pretty great foot chase.
Sure.
And I also like the Godfather homage of the oranges tumbling down the staircase.
Yeah.
Some people accused us jointly in email of, like, I can't believe you preferred all the Reddit bullshit theories to what we actually got, because those are stupid, too. And I'm like, well, the only reason we came up with that is just for the sheer disbelief that what we saw last episode was just a barefaced
right.
Truth. Yeah. Know, because it's...
It felt so weird. It didn't feel like Arya.
Like, I feel like the way this ended, if you'd have just started this, like, the foot chase, like so the Waif tries to get Arya, and she gets a good slash across her belly, she maybe slashes her in the arm, and then the foot chase ensues, and Arya leads her back, like, with a blood trail back to her lair and kills her in the dark. That's right. Essentially what we thought was going to happen at 5:06.
Yeah, and if she's, like, shown just kind of slicing her and then hiding, and slicing her and hiding, like, you could do something, like, where
yeah.
the same, like, make-her-suffer point is there.
Sure.
Without
sure.
stabbing her in the guts and twisting a knife.
That makes Arya smart, because all the people that wrote in and say, well, you guys are just missing the fact that Arya led the way into this trap, are missing all the things that were just pure luck that happened. Like, the fact
right.
that, like, Arya could have been killed. Like, if the Waif had done what Jaqen had said and just slit her throat,
yeah.
she'd have been dead.
Right.
If Arya drinks the milk of the poppy and is knocked out, and the Waif shows up at the lady, what's her name, Claire?
Crane?
Lady yeah. Crane's house, she's dead. Like, it's not a smart luring of the trap if many points along the way Arya could have been killed with no action on her own part.
Right.
And they could have done that, but, like, for some reason in the writer's room, they got the idea that having this bullshit cliffhanger with Arya was a smart idea. And that's, I think that is the root cause of failure here. They don't do that, and this is...
Yeah.
There's still some problems with why Jaqen is doing all this, and what exactly the relationship is, and what does it mean when he pronounces her no one. I got some ideas on that. I've kind of calmed down on that a little bit. But honestly, root cause of failure is the gut stabbing and
yeah.
her sliding into and
completely.
Getting away. Yeah, all that stuff otherwise is fine.
Right, and I just can't forgive it. It's too bad.
Yes.
It's too bad that they botched up this thing.
It doesn't ruin Arya going, because it doesn't change the essential arc that she's on.
Right.
It's just a real letdown from a storytelling perspective, because I just don't see any way you can spin this as Arya being smart and competent and a skilled assassin she's been training to be
right.
when she made so many. Like, I would have bought that she's going around swaggering and throwing gold to lure the Waif out, except it almost got her killed.
Yeah.
And she went crawling back to the person who's marked for death by the Faceless Men, the person that she's trying to hide out from. It really doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. And I mean, I don't know. I do kind of like the Bloodsport shit that they pulled with her cutting the lights and using that.
Sure.
The training that the Waif inadvertently gave her.
And I know some people were angry about not getting to see this epic fight. Like, we've seen this.
What?
We've seen
how
the
are
Waif.
You going to see it? It's in
I
the dark.
Know. But you know that there's ways that you can film stuff in darkness
right.
that you can still see enough of what's going on. But
yeah.
I don't feel like that, because it's a stylistic choice. Like, I understand the people that do, because we've watched this Waif beat the shit out of Arya all season long, so we want to see some comeuppance, and we didn't see a bit of it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, that's the one part I think did work. Like, her kind of blending the Faceless Men in her water dancing training, and bam, she gets the better of the Waif.
Yeah.
But holy shit, everything that connected those two ideas, her hiding in the dark and her actually executing it, was terrible. Terrible. And again...
Yeah.
stuff that was, I can't believe that George Martin said, you got to have her stabbed in the guts, and you got to have the knife
and
twisted.
Twist that knife.
And really, I also got some people emailing me, and was like, well, that's not necessarily a fatal injury.
No,
like,
come on. You're wrong. You're just wrong about that.
If you think that you're supposed to watch that and think that, oh, Arya's going to be fine, I'm sure she didn't nick her intestines.
She'll just sleep
or
it
her
off.
Kidney or her
right.
liver. Like,
or her... right, I mean, just...
Like, that's desperate
and fall
grasping.
Into a fucking shit-filled river.
Yes.
From all... Like... All of this is real stupid.
Right.
Like, nobody sat back and thought, well, how would she survive this believably?
Like, if she ran off to a maester that she had befriended, or, like, a red priestess that could do... Or
maybe.
Or even a renegade faceless man, like the Cyril Pharrell thing, and he's got some kind of crazy potion. But
right.
I don't believe that an amateur...
No.
Hole patcher upper with milk a poppy can do it. I just don't.
Yeah.
And if you do, more power to you. But I'm saying that, like, I've gotten probably 1,000 emails on the subject, and the vast majority of people are like, what the fuck? So even if 5% of the audience says, oh, this is pretty good, 95% doesn't, it's a failure of storytelling.
Right. And none of the defenses I've seen, like you said before, have accounted for all of it.
They have, yeah. Like, there's some that make sense from this and that, but they don't, I don't think, holistically look at the entire situation.
Right. And ultimately, I guess it comes down to opinion. If you liked it, fine.
And you're right.
I'm just go with it. But I hated it. I thought it was terrible.
And I'm not saying that any of that stuff we talked about last week was great. Like this is a Fight Club situation, and the waif is a figment of Mitch
testing waif and all that shit. Yeah,
yeah. Or Arya slapped a face on some innocent pastor. Like, none of that stuff was great.
Right.
Arguably better than what happened, though.
Right. We were grasping at straws for something that made sense
because we didn't want to believe it was just going to be this stupid.
Yeah. And it turns out it was. I mean, Arya is Arya, waif is waif. This, all of this is bullshit.
And I'm not reading, I don't think, any of these. I might have included one or two. But there are still some people that are saying, well, what if the waif did kill Arya? Now she's going to infiltrate the house. And I'm like, okay, maybe. But what? No.
So she puts her own face up on the wall?
I guess, yeah.
How would that even happen? And then assumes Arya's face? Can you even do that?
That's the thing we don't, and that's the thing that's annoying, is because people are saying, well, why did Jack, well, who the hell knows? Because we still don't know. Like, that's frustrating that 2 years into this, we really don't know any more about the Faceless Men than I did when I read the fucking books and I was halfway through the plot. What is Jack, and also, I guess it leads a little bit more credence to the Arya's special and that Jacken's doing something with her, because...
Right.
And I'm not getting into, there's like lots of people that said, like, it's stupid the fact that she's snuck back in and she's, you know, gut wounded and she's dripping blood and no one in the House of Faceless and in the House of Black and White is alerted to the fact that she's creeping around and in their inner sanctum.
Right. What should be a mortally injured girl dragging the body of a fresh kill into the Hall of Black and White just seems like.
I'm not, but that's nitpicking.
Right.
That's,
you don't even have to go that far.
Major structural problem. And why is Jacken pleased that she become? I do feel like I understand finally what he meant, because it seems like one of the things when he poisoned himself last year and Arya freaked out because she was his friend, that the fact that she was ready to kill him, and the fact that she's divorced all attachment to like her what she considers friends, I think that's why he said you're no one. And then she says, fuck you, I'm Arya Stark. And he smiles, I'm guessing because that's what he wanted her to do. Like,
yeah, I mean, you got to go all the way back to when they first met, right? And,
yeah.
And try and analyze, like, why does he bring her over? Why does he give her the coin?
And I don't know, but I'm not ready to say it's stupid because I don't know. So I guess I'm,
right.
You know, just, and this could be me committing the same mistake I did last episode, which is I think they've got a better reason than they're giving me, so... But I don't know what his game. I don't know whether this is him acting on his own. Like some people were saying, I saw some theories on Reddit about, well, maybe Jacken had an experience like this. And yeah, he's no one, but he still admires a little girl's need to avenge her family, and that's kind of honoring the faceless god in its own way. And he's like sent off his guided missile, and I don't know. And I'm increasingly as we go through this. The death of the Clegane Bowl and some of the other stuff, it's like I'm starting to get burnt out by rampant theorizing.
Right.
You know, and it's like starting to get more like wishful thinking and people just telling themselves stories that sound good. And
sure.
I don't know. I'm not in the mood for it this week.
Let me tell you a story that sounds good to me.
All right.
what if, I don't have any evidence yet because it's just speculation, Arya's going back to Westeros. Could she be useful to Jon and Sansa? Could she use her newfound powers, her powers of face manipulation, to maybe find a crack in the wall that is around Winterfell? Get inside, maybe using a face familiar to Roose, Miranda, to Ramsay, maybe Miranda or Roose or another face, someone else. Because we don't actually know when this is happening, right? And that's all we've talked about this in the past. We don't know how these timelines line up.
I thought it was interesting that Lord Edmure, just for this point, in August, this point, said that I've been kept in a cell for years, implying that almost real time has elapsed.
Okay.
Like, he was in prison in season 3, and now it's 3 years later. I've been here for years. So I don't... that's a good question. Like, if she showed up next week, do you buy it?
Right. I think a lot of people wouldn't.
Especially since we last left... I mean, to be useful for the Battle of the Bastards, which is happening next week, she would have to literally show up next week.
Right.
So I don't know. But you're right. There's nothing. They are playing kind of fast and loose with the fluidity of time. That would be useful. I mean, that's the thing. Like, Arya is fascinating because she could be used for so many different things.
Yeah.
And, like, there's literally endless possibilities. Do you want to hear 15 different people give 15 different ideas about what it's going to be?
Is that what the feedback is?
No,
this week?
Because I, in Todd Cox, is saying, no, because it's not interesting to me. I'm sorry. I know a lot of people want to count.
You're burnt out on the theorizing.
There's Reddit and forums if you want to, someplace of the archive, how right you were about certain things. But, like, and I can't get it all right. Like, I didn't read someone's email last week that said essentially that I bet King Tommen just outlaws trial by combat because the idea seemed preposterous to me.
Right.
I was like, there's no way. That's like the law of the land. You can't just change, like, what is this, a United States election? You can't just change rules and do shit like, but when they did it on the screen, I'm like, well, that made sense, and I kind of probably should have read that, but.
Sure.
There's 100 other things that I think are preposterous that haven't come true, so what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You read them all, and you try to do the best job you can.
Well, that is, in fact, the end of the episode and the end of the recap.
Hey, this week's podcast is sponsored by Casper, who is the online purveyor of really quality mattresses. I'm going to talk about them because I've been sleeping on one for over a year now, and I think they're pretty awesome. There are well-engineered mattress at shockingly fair prices. $500 for a twin size, up to $950 for a king-size mattress. And you can get $50 off your first order by going to casper.com/GOT. And using the GOT promo code during checkout. Terms and conditions apply. The thing about Casper is they're not just latex foam or memory foam like other mattresses. They're a blend of the two that gives you just the right sink and just the right bounce to give you a good night's sleep. They're made in America. And the biggest selling point, I think, is their risk-free trial, because I'd like to see you go to any mattress store, purchase a mattress, and then return it after 99 days of sleeping on it and see what they say. Casper, they're so confident that they will ship you this in a night. And that's the other thing. Like, if you're living in an upstairs apartment like me, you have to wrestle a king-size mattress up. You wrestle a 50-pound, 3-foot by 2-foot by 2-foot box. A lot easier. Mattress all folds out and takes its right shape. But if you don't like it, they will come and pick it up free of charge, and they've got several options for recycling or donations, but you don't have to worry about it. That's how confident they are in their mattress technology. You buy it and try it for 100 days. So, you know, if you're in the market for a mattress, I highly recommend you go to casper.com/GOT and use the GOT code. Of course, some terms and conditions apply, but if you're in the market for a mattress, check out Casper. They're awesome.
Do we have some feedback to do?
Oh, Yes, we do. Unfortunately, even though we got a ton of feedback, there's a lot of feedback, so you could just essentially put into three different camps. So I try to get some unique takes and some retrospective responses from those. As is our want, the first few emails are from past episodes. Ariel says, I'm trying to figure out something. Is this show trying to set up Cersei and the Lannisters as the good guys in the conflict with the High Sparrow? I feel like it is, but I just keep finding myself nodding my head at the stuff the High Sparrow says.
Really?
Yes, he may be a dangerous guy himself, but he's not wrong that the Lannisters, and Tyrells for that matter, have abused their power over others simply by virtue of the fact that they have fancier clothes and sharper swords. I mean, Is the threat of the faith poses to the Lannisters and Tyrells really anything more than you don't get to have absolute arbitrary power over the lives of commoners anymore? To put this another way, is anyone in King's Landing other than Lannisters, Tyrells themselves worse off if the High Sparrow either beats the Lannisters or Tyrells or at least sticks around to balancing them out? Playing the Ronald Reagan card, are you really better under the Lannisters and Tyrells than you were 8 years ago?
Right.
Is the Lannister-Tyrell argument that we deserve to be in charge just because supposed to be appealing? The faith may represent a different sort of tyranny, but isn't the High Sparrow's version of the King's Landing preferable to one where the Lannisters get to have babies killed on a whim and random citizens are murdered for making jokes about the Lannisters?
No. I don't think any kind of absolute moral authority like that can ever be considered a good thing.
But it's also, I mean, I think it's a fascinating argument. It's essentially to kind of like, well, maybe Saddam Hussein wasn't so bad because, yes, political prisoners got disappeared in the middle of the streets, but for the lives of the average Iraqis, it's maybe better than it is now.
Maybe. You know, it's like, sure, like, there's an argument to be made from
like
both
sides.
Like,
if lightning strikes you, you're fucked, but on the other hand, the streets were relatively safe, and I could buy things, and I didn't have madmen coming with guns. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's...
To me, they're both the bad guys. Like, I don't think there is a good guy in this situation.
And I think that's what maybe I differ with Ari, is that you're trying to find which of the two extreme positions is preferable when really you look for a middle ground. Like, effective rule of law that's not... Because the thing is, High Septon gets into power, and now he's going to punish adultery by death, and fornication by death, and homosexuality by death. And, you know, what is the eyes... and what is pure and what is not pure is ultimately how he interprets the scripture.
Yep.
That's a different kind of capriciousness bullshit than the tyranny of the rich.
But it's ultimately the same thing.
It's
just interpreted differently. It's just
applied
differently.
And arguably, also, that could be even worse because, again, you know, if you kept your head down and you didn't, you know, throw shit at the wrong lord, you probably were able to exist just fine in King's Landing. But as a Faith of the Seven, like, you could have some robed jackass come and see you, you know,
but it's
getting
it's
drunk, and then now you're dead. Like,
it's exactly the same thing, though. I mean, if the Lannisters, you know, see you doing something they don't like, they're going to kill you. If the faith militants see you doing something they don't like, they're going to kill you.
But those are specific things. Like, the Lannisters are not going to go down and kill you just because you're fucking around and flea bottom. If you're talking shit about them, those are things that, like, you know, like, is it better to punish people for their base desires or for political speech? You know, I guess that's, like, they're both important. Like, freedom of speech is as important as being able to get your drink on and just enjoy the, you know, your vices in life. It's like, which, because the Lannisters don't give a shit if you're whoring or drinking or gambling. They don't. They just don't want you speaking against the crown.
Whereas
the High Septon doesn't give a shit about you talking shit to power, but he's not going to let you gamble and whore and drink.
Sure. I will say my personal opinion on this, in as much as there is any good guy in this scenario, I think it more closely tracks with the Lannisters. So I roughly agree with you. What I won't say is that anybody is actually good.
Yeah.
I will say that they are both really bad things to have kind of in your kingdom.
Right. And the thing is like, if the opposite of crazy is still crazy, that's why I'm saying, like, I think that we're offered a false dichotomy. Do you want the religious nut job or the uncaring, unfeeling, powerful that don't even give a shit and trample you? You want the middle path.
Sure.
You want someone in power that protects the people
and
preserves their liberties
the way they want,
such as they are. This next one I'm going to read just so I stop getting email on it. Ken I, one of the many, 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 many people that suggest, is Sansa pregnant? Remember when she told Littlefinger that she can feel still inside what Ramsay did to her? Hello? Jim, what do you think of this theory?
I don't think she is.
I think it's a very peculiar way to read the statement of a rape victim. Like, if Ramsay Bolton raped me, I could say I can still feel what he did inside me, and I would not be talking about a baby.
Right.
So, that's it. She could very well be pregnant. I don't think this is evidence of that. This is her telling Littlefinger, making him confront the awfulness and not use euphemisms, but explicitly, as Sansa can be, making him feel what she went through because of his bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Again, Sansa could be pregnant, but this line is not evidence that she is. And also, does anyone really want to see Sansa pregnant with a Bolton baby?
I don't. That's Jesus disgusting.
Christ. Jesus Christ.
Maybe George Martin does.
Well, maybe.
Maybe he's just that sick of a fuck.
Then we can open up those fun arguments again.
Yep.
Zach B. says, a theme I am sensing. Characters on the show for who... Whoa, whoa. The theme I'm sensing, Aaron cannot speak. Characters on the show who were once powerful in times of desperation, unleashing a weapon or creating an alliance to help them in the short term that gets out of hand in the long, ultimately... in the long term, ultimately disposing of their power or life. Examples we've already seen happen. Children of the Forest, the White Walkers, Viserys Targaryen and Khal Drogo, the Lannisters and the Tyrells, Cersei with the Faith Militant, Stannis with the Red Woman, and Robb Stark with the Freys. In each case, characters that were desperate or deteriorating situations make alliances or unleash others to help them secure their position in the short term to ultimately have these weapons be their downfall, and ultimately making Westeros and Essos bear the brunt of their shotgun weddings. This foreshadows recent alliances that may lead to negative outcomes, and this is the point I want to get your opinion on, Jim. Cersei and the Mountain, Jaime and Bronn, and Dany, and pick one of her dragons, the Dothraki, or the Second Sons, or Varys. So the Mountain turning against Cersei, that's an interesting possibility.
I don't see it. I mean, he seems to be unswervingly loyal.
But to who? To Qyburn or Cersei or... I don't really understand his programming or even what that means.
The Mountain is always seen by Cersei's side. I would think if he was unswervingly loyal to Qyburn, he'd always be by Qyburn's side. So I don't see it being Qyburn.
But do you think Qyburn has like a backdoor? A backdoor into the Mountain that...
Is he going to stick his finger up?
Yep. He's going to show him how to kiss.
No, I think the Mountain is Cersei's toy.
I agree, but I think that if Qyburn is half as smart as I think he is, he would put in a failsafe to where if Cersei says, kill Qyburn, the Mountain says, does not compute, and smashes her instead. Otherwise, Qyburn's way too trusting of an unstable person.
Sure. I don't know. I don't see any evidence of that, but okay.
I don't see any evidence either. It's just me... And look how well my assuming people are smarter than they are theories have gone. Jaime and Bronn. Now that's a good one, because Bronn would absolutely slit Jaime's throat if it got him a bigger bag of gold, a prettier lady, or a bigger castle.
I think so.
And also, I think it's interesting that this episode he mentioned he prefers working for the younger brother, and he mentioned because he's sick and tired of the way ladies look at Jaime, but. Mm. If everything goes the way we think is going to go, Jaime and Tyrion are going to be in opposition pretty soon.
Could be, yeah.
And if Bronn thinks that Tyrion's got the upper hand and maybe he's got a little bit more residual affection, I could see that going badly for Jaime.
Mm-hmm. Especially if Jaime doesn't deliver on this fucking castle and bride. Come on.
Yeah.
It's about time.
Finally, Dany, we've talked about how bringing a bunch of essentially horse-bound wildlings to Westeros that don't follow their religion or culture is probably not the smartest idea.
Yeah.
Nor a bunch of sellswords, nor the spider and the dragons being hard to control. You could have 5 feedbacks full of what could go wrong there. But I do like that. Also, some more in discussion of us talking about landmines and other allegories for Martin's work. Nicholas J. chimed in, said, I've been thinking about this for a while, and your talk of landmines meant I had to write in. Surely a more apt analogy to make with the real world is the Night's King was a nuclear weapon created by the Children of the Forest to stop a war like the United States, but instead created a cold war, literally.
Leaf is Oppenheimer.
She has to become death.
Right.
I mean, there's even a huge wall of ice like the one in Berlin, or the metaphorical Iron Curtain that spread across the whole of Europe during the real Cold War. The comparisons can go on and on. For example, many people that were stuck in East Germany tried to get over, under, or around the wall to West Germany, but were executed for trying. Some of the people that managed to leave communist countries were shunned or looked upon with suspicion as spies by people in the West. The similarities to the wildlings there seem obvious. It could all be completely unintentional. I know in the foreword to Lord of the Rings, Tolkien said, "I cordially dislike allegory and all its manifestations, and always have done so since I grew old and wary enough to detect its presence." But people still make the same allegorical comparisons to his work. And with all respect to Tolkien, I'm a big believer in a death of the author idea in critical analysis. So okay. I don't give a shit what you say, Tolkien.
Right. Well, let me throw this out. I know you're going to say, I don't give a shit what you say, Martin, but
okay.
I did watch an interview with George Martin where he was essentially asked this question about some recent events and whether or not his stories had anything to do with modern history. Contemporary
yes.
history as it's being made.
Sure.
And he essentially said no. Like, he based this story a lot on the War of the Roses, sure. but he is not trying to make a point about anything currently going on. In his stories. Now, I don't know if that holds true of the show.
Well, this is interesting because Brian McKay, I'm going to let him retort from okay. beyond the email. In the last episode, you mentioned how mismanagement of the Night's King, yada, yada, yada. Martin has stated in or started the books after Operation Desert Storm, and as these have been written during the war in Iraq, and he has made a number of public comments on his writing being reflective of his feelings during these times.
Huh.
I therefore think a better comparison than Minefields is the U.S. enabling Saddam Hussein, or you could even go back to the Mujahideen, I hope I pronounced that correct, in Afghanistan, and arming him in to fight against Iran, then years later having to fight and subdue the same ally that they had arguably created. Okay. And I get it. Anytime you talk about politics, it's shorter than 50 years ago, it's fraught with peril, but and I don't know what the public writing is.
It sounds like it's just conflicting
yeah.
statements from him.
And I well, because
I watched him, the man, say it.
Sure,
so, like,
and I don't have the So Spake Mate Martin chapter and verse here that he's referring to, but I'm going to take him at his word.
I believe him, yeah.
And I also think that you can say these writings inspired the mood, but not they're not necessarily allegorical. Like
Or right, the idea
like the
that...
The Night's King is not literally Saddam Hussein. But these are some ideas
sure.
I've kind of woven into the War of the Rings, or War of the... Jesus, wrong fiction, wrong nonfiction. War of the Roses.
And of course, I mean, your thoughts on certain subject matters are going to influence your writing as it's happening.
Yeah.
You can't avoid that. You are who you are.
Which, that's why I like the death of the author approach, because the author has subconscious biases and things
right.
that he's or she is not even aware of. So
right.
why should I take their gospel? Like, if something's in there and can be supported by the text, it's valid. If
yeah,
it's not, then it's not.
It's the difference between purposely, consciously putting something in there
yeah.
to make a statement versus, of course, my mood influences my writing.
Right. I mean, this blew up on Reddit last week. Someone posted one of those, "Today I Learned," like Ray Bradbury claims that Fahrenheit 451 was never an allegory about censorship, but was about the dumbing down of Western civilization by... television and movies destroying their ability to appreciate longer, more reasoned works and books.
Okay.
And I'm like, what the fuck? Because, like, you go through high school and you read Fahrenheit 451 and it's shoved down your throat that this is a statement about censorship.
Uh-huh.
So, it happens, man.
Yeah. And the author may not even be aware of it.
And no one cares. Chris I. In episode 606, it's Tarly dinner scene. Sam's mother mentions that they once met a man, a Lord Umber, from the Last Hearth. The context was intended to show that Tarlys have heard that Northerners teach their daughters to hunt, but do you think there's any significance to why the writers felt the need to specifically drop the name Lord Umber? I'm fuzzy on the overall timelines, but if this chance encounter happened at any time within the past couple of years, isn't it strange for either the Tarly family to be that far north or for Lord Umber to be that far south?
I don't know. I don't know enough about this.
That's
to really
the thing.
Say.
Like, there's the plain reading, which is she's just trying desperately to find common cause with this girl from the north and make uh-huh. things less awkward. So, like, she once met Lord Umber at a dinner party, and the thing is, you got to understand, like, these people go to these tourneys all the time. Like, mm-hmm. they might go to a tourney at Harrenhal or King's Landing or in Dorne or in the north, and like mm-hmm. you, it could it, as I can think that. That this dinner, you're thinking like a modern dinner where like a couple invites another couple over, where this could be
yeah.
like this massive
feast.
Yeah. Like, and they're just seated at the same table.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, this could be complex foreshadowing that shows that somehow the Tarlys and Umbers are going to unite and, you know,
oh
proclaim John as the king of the north and blah, blah, blah. So
uh-huh.
I just wanted to get it out there because again, I've had people sending me this a couple weeks in a row, and I just want to get out there. I don't know what it means. It could mean something, could mean nothing. But again, the plain reading of it is it's just her trying to make small talk, a very awkward small talk with this awkward situation. Mm-hmm. Juliana P. said, I read this article this morning on BuzzFeed called I Really Wish Arya Stark Had Just Fucking Died in the Episode. The author basically says that he would have liked Arya to die in Braavos because her storyline the past few years has been painful. The author says, we've been watching 2 years of Arya not becoming a faceless man, knowing that if she could never and would never become a faceless man, knowing that she didn't even want to become a faceless man. It's only now that she's trying to leave that we're seeing just how pointless it really was. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this argument. I disagree with the author because her death after her time in Braavos would seem even more pointless and much more of a waste of time. I still have hope that Arya will return to her badassness, but I understand her frustration and do long for a storyline to return to the fierce, sassy character from seasons 1 through 4. He also brings up some interesting points. I'm going to leave that for the spoiler. Arya.
Okay, so I don't think it's a complete waste of time. I somewhat agree with the idea that, you know, it was all for nothing because we knew that Arya wasn't going to become a faceless man. I don't think anybody thought, well, that's just Arya now, and she's going to be contract killing for the rest of her life, and she's never going to mark the names off this list and all that stuff. I think the reason they did this is to get her properly trained, to get her in a position where she could execute on that list, because if Arya before the Faceless Men goes and tries to kill a bunch of people, I don't know that I buy it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a lot harder to buy. Now that she knows how to blend in, she knows how to fight, I think it's, you know, it took a long time to get her there. Mm-hmm. I'll agree with that, but I think it was useful.
I'm even going to take a stronger take. I think this entire line of argument is shite. And that this BuzzFeed person is a shite arguer, because it's like, you knew going into season one that Breaking Bad was the story of Mr. Chips the Scarface.
Right.
There was no, like, is Walt going to do the right thing at the... I mean, in the margins, but that's not the story you waded through 5 seasons of television to see. The Wire is a story about Baltimore and its moral and societal and cultural decay and what is causing it. There's not like, oh, is Baltimore going to not become a shithole, war-torn drug city by the end? I seriously question what this guy's just fucking writing clickbait, because serious critical person could possibly question the wisdom of showing a person's character development, even if the character development you knew what was going to happen. Like, unless it's just, unless you think that a whole storyline with her and Braavos was shit, which I don't think it was.
No.
Like, in fact, up until this latest misstep is where I get really angry about it. And again, it didn't change anything about her path. It's just...
And it gives her a lot of exciting tools. I mean, this idea that she can change faces, it just opens that character up.
Yes.
Her ability to wield a sword and fight opens that character up. I think they needed this.
This isn't a critical argument. This is someone being petulant on the internet.
Yeah, and writing, I think Arya should have died to get 1 million clicks. Like,
yes.
You're right. It's clickbait. It's ridiculous, like, whatever.
I mean, there's a room for it. It's probably on message boards and Reddit. I don't know that, you know, like, it's a serious work of journalism, but then again, it's BuzzFeed, so
sure.
And also, it's like, I'd be mortified if he quotes my dumbass as any kind of serious critical work either. It's just, I put that out as a disclaimer. I don't know what I'm doing, so much less than half the time. Nick K, do you think that Stannis Baratheon's fleet will come into play? This is an interesting question.
Stannis Baratheon's fleet?
Presumably the Night's Watch still have custody of the fleet after Jon Snow borrowed it to move the wildlings from Hardhome. Bet you forgot about that, didn't you?
I did forget about that, yeah.
My bet is on the White Walkers boarding the ships at some point, sending a contingent of whites down to King's Landing for a naval assault.
What?
I don't know about that.
They didn't take the ships with them?
Well, I've got to be honest, I don't know where the disposition of this fleet, because it existed. It seemed like it more or less intact left Hardhome because we got all these thousands of wildlings as survivors. But on the other hand, they sure not at Castle Black. They're probably at Eastwatch by the Sea, I'm guessing. But
I guess.
How
like,
could
send
they?
Send the children wildlings off. Do like a Rufio style bangarang thing with the kids and send them off on boats.
Yeah.
And see how that works out. Because apparently the women can fight, right? The wildling women?
Sure.
They're trained to fight.
Sure. So. I think that it's not so much they're trained to fight, it's just that there's not
enough.
They do
fight.
They have to.
They're vicious.
I feel like that, well, check your non-wilding privilege. I wouldn't say they're vicious. They're just doing what they got to do to survive, Jim. Jesus.
Well, in a battle, they're probably vicious.
Sure. They're appropriately vicious.
Yeah.
To the time and temperament that, you know, they're not hasty or whatever. Whatever. I'm not going to.
And you're putting a lot. You're speculating a lot on the temperament of these wildling women who we've seen very little of.
I don't know. Because dollars to donuts, they've just forgotten about these ships, too. And I don't think they've forgotten, but
they're just not interested in in dealing with them at the moment.
Now, when the Winds of Winter comes out, whether Martin remembers and there's some kind of cool overarching strategy and John goes over and proposes to Danny and kisses her a bunch on the ships, I don't know. But
they're going to get a bunch of Tullys and a bunch of catapults.
Sure.
They're going to light them up and send them over the Winterfell walls from the sea.
Yep. Yep, that's exactly what's going to happen.
Big catapults.
But I thought it was worth asking because it is a piece on the board that largely people have forgotten about. Jonathan A. from the Bay Area, who I hear do not back down. Everyone says the title of Episode 9, The Battle of the Bastards, needs no explanation. Jonathan says, not so fast.
Oh.
Obviously, Jon versus Ramsay is going to be the central conflict, but when thinking of potential twists that can potentially pop up in the episode, I think you have to start with other prominent bastards in the show. And from there, I think you look no further than the Sand Snakes. They have the bad poussée. The Sand Snakes were reintroduced in this beginning of Season 6, and then nothing. We left Dorne with Ilaria and the snakes assassinating Prince Doran and making promises of war. Since then, it's almost as if the show has done everything it can to make sure the audiences forget they exist. I think the Sand Snakes are due for a big comeback in Episode 9. Bring the Battle of the Bastards down to King's Landing, where everyone else's attention is either at Winterfell or Riverrun. My prediction, at least one prominent Lannister character will die to the Sand Snakes in Episode 9. That's a pretty hot take, because they are also bastards, prominently bastards, and they have also been laying low the way snakes do in the grass before they're about to strike.
Yeah, that's something I forgot about. We haven't talked about how all of Cersei's stuff going down in King's Landing right now might be affected by the Dornish armies showing up, right?
Yes. Do you think Lady Olenna makes a pact with the Martells, like, essentially, look, this Lannister thing's a fucking fiasco.
That would be perfect, because then I could
interchange...
You
want what I want... You could interchange what?
I could mix up their names and it wouldn't be a problem. The Tyrell armies. Oh, sure. They're partially
Tyrell. Yeah, sure. The armies of El. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it's something we haven't considered. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth considering for sure.
Jan M. said, hey guys, sorry I'm not great with names. I'm surprised you guys didn't think it was interesting that Varys left right before the slavers came back to Marine.
Well, it was an instant take.
What is that
take.
Guy up to? Huh?
It was an instant take.
It was an instant take.
I mean, that's
take.
The nature of it.
Yeah, and also, you happen to be the very first one to send that in to us, because many, many people did, so I want to give you credit,
right.
Even though ultimately it's a bit of dry pie at this point. Mm-hmm. Caitlin T. said, with only two episodes left this season, and the next one completely dedicated to the Bastard Bowl, I feel like there is still a lot of unanswered questions we might not get to, such as, are we done with Dorne? Did everyone forget that they murdered their prince and Princess Myrcella? Jaime even mentioned tonight how Cersei wants Sansa dead for Joffrey's murder, but no vengeance for Myrcella. Tyrion unchained those dragons a long while ago. Have they just been hanging out down there? And also, what could possibly be important enough at the Citadel to keep Sam en route this whole time? What is the purpose of his storyline now? You know what? In Episode 4, I would have been amazed that heading into the final two-episode stretch, we didn't have the answers to some of these questions.
Yeah.
Especially those dragons, like I said, like, oh, well, they're not going to stay down there, obviously. They're going to get free and do something, but we literally haven't heard anything about them.
Yeah. I wonder if Danny's going to be pissed. Oh, you let my dragons loose? What the fuck, Tyrion?
Yeah. Like, Sam, it's been several episodes since he stole the sword.
Just sent Drogon on his lunch break. Like, I needed those fucking dragons.
Yeah. He's tired. He's been doing a
right.
lot. Where are my other dragons? Where are my... Oh, that's the rest of the season will be... We're due for another Where Are My Dragons season. Danny.
Yeah, season 7.
Yeah, season 7 is going to be the return of Where Are My Dragons? No, all valid points, Caitlin. And I don't have any ideas. Like, what is going on? Maybe the dragons fight in unison next episode. Who knows? I do think that it's a little overstated. I don't know that the Battle of the Bastards will be a single episode. I don't think they have, even though the last episode's, what, 69 minutes long? Mm-hmm. It's almost 70 minutes long. I don't think they have enough time to devote a single episode to a single battle. Like, I just can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, even in Hardhome, yeah, they did a lot more than just Hardhome.
Yeah, like Blackwater, is that the only episode where they've done something like that?
Maybe. Was that entirely that battle?
I feel like it was. Yeah, it was entirely. But there was a lot of point of views there. It was like, you know, Cersei and her kids and
Tyrion and Joffrey.
Yeah, there was a lot of things to kind of get around to. And Stannis and his men. Right. So I don't know that you get the same with the Bastard Bowl. So I would be surprised if there isn't some sand snakes in there, if there wasn't some other, you know, pieces moved about the board to set up for the finale.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan B., a lot of people want us to know what we think is going to happen, and so far we've been like, But we'll see if we can do better on this one. Hey, guys, do you think with Jaime completing his task and taking back River Run, he will immediately ride back to King's Landing just in time to witness Cersei's trial and find out about her many indiscretions? If so, will Jaime stand by Cersei? Will he turn his back on her and go find Brienne, sulk back to Castle Rock? Or will he go nuclear on the way out and divulge Tommen's true parentage? Oh, boy. A lot of people speculating that this is a long con for the High Sparrow to end the Lannister line by essentially saying, you're a product of incest, and get Cersei to admit that on a stand, which would invalidate the royal line.
Yeah, wouldn't it also invalidate his claim to
legitimacy? That's the interesting thing about the Twin Pillars. That's something he's had.
Right. He's tied himself so closely to the crown now.
But it's Joffrey saying it in public. Tommen saying it in public. So, like, I eschewed the theory that he was going to supplant Tommen for a different king, but maybe he will.
Maybe. I don't think Jaime's going to get back in time for this trial. It doesn't seem likely to me. It seems more likely that the trial will have happened, Jaime will get back and be furious for those reasons.
Yeah.
Whatever happens at the trial, whether Cersei's killed, whether Cersei destroys the city.
I mean, they keep on making a point about how much he loves his sister.
Yeah.
And if she cheated on him with fucking Lancel, of all people, I can see, you know, that being a huge rift in their relationship.
Or I can just see her being dead and him being pissed. Like, I don't know. But I just don't think he's going to make it back in time for the trial.
Him going and getting back involved in Brienne seems like a good bet, because that final wave did not feel like a farewell, never see you again kind of thing.
Really? I thought it kind of did.
Did you?
Yeah.
Fuck you. Fuck you, setting
fuck
my...
Fuck you for having an opinion.
Setting my ships ablaze. What are you?
Sorry.
I
don't know. Felt like it to me, but
what do you think this divulging of Tommen's true parentage? I gave my opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I was getting at. If she divulges that information, what does that do to the High Sparrow's hold on the city?
Because you think that he's bound up his, but to me, I could think he could just say, well, I was just as shocked and fooled as all you, and this changes everything. And
I suppose so.
Maybe he crowns himself king. Who knows? That was another idea that I thought was outlandish, but what the fuck do I know?
Crown Lancel king. Is he the closest that they have to a rightful heir at this point?
Well, maybe we can get another, it turns out, erroneous history of the...
Yeah. The get Lannister Kevin line. Up there. I don't know.
We need Danny.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting if the... Nah, there's no way the High Septon's going to send a raven over to her saying, hey, we got your home back. All you got to do is submit to this. Because that's... I mean, it's interesting they're setting up this religious war between the Lord of the Light, and that would be a big sticking point.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I could see a storyline where the people start clamoring for the Targaryens again, and they hear about Dany and the great things she's doing over there, and the High Septon's like, yeah, and she's setting the slaves free, and maybe, but oh, she's got the Red Priestess and priests all up, all upon. I don't know.
Yeah.
Travis C. Has a disagreement about Arya's storyline. He goes, you think Arya's storyline is perfunctory storytelling? No, sirs, the half-assed Reddit theories, in quotation marks, you gave credence to last week were perfunctory. It was clear from early on that this storyline was meant to cement the notion that Arya is a Stark and nothing but a Stark, and there's no getting away from that, death or otherwise. Arya's the waif, Jaqen's the waif. Seriously? This is a natural progression of the story, dudes. Jaqen clearly has affection for Arya, and a major theme of the piece as a whole, as you've stated, is the feudal warring of religious factions. This is the show exploring that theme further. Someone as devout as the waif and Jaqen to the many-faced god have no place in the winter and the war to come. The waif especially so, and now she is dead. Jaqen's character seems wise and more willing to roll with the punches, thus his fast and loose dealings with Arya early on in the show. And the Clegane Bowl? Fuck the Clegane Bowl. It's meaningless. Why are we even talking about it?
Oh my god. The mountain, I can't wait for the whole internet to shit on this guy.
The Mountain and Sandor have their own things going on. They're pretty compelling unto themselves. Why are we cheapening their individual stations, situations with this hype? Ah, a hype slayer.
All right.
Another hype slayer.
Let me just say, I think you're full of shit. I think that the problems are so obvious with this line that I don't have to explain them any further. We've been over it.
I think he's not wrong about the overall point of the storyline, right? Which is not the argument we were making.
It's not. The reason we were looking for explanations is because what they showed us on the screen made zero sense.
Yes.
It was fucking terrible. And we were looking for some way to patch those holes
in
the boat, and they just weren't there. Like, sure, our stuff was insane, but it was only insane because we were trying to explain a thing that was terrible
was crazy,
and made
no
sense.
Yeah.
Like, how do you explain away all of the bad stuff we've talked about with Arya's plotline at this point?
It's like the Greeks used to think Apollo drugged the sun across in a chariot. That's bat shit, but they didn't know any better. They were just trying to explain why this fucking ball of fire keeps coming up every day.
Right. I don't know. I don't know what to say to people who actually think that was good.
I do think Travis is right on, even in his religious analysis. That's kind of interesting, too. And also, the Clegane, you're just being mean now.
Right, exactly.
Clegane Bowl's cool.
People want to see it.
And hopefully they'll replace it with something even cooler. And that's the other thing. It's like, I'm not going to blame the fan base for wanting to see something that was hinted at in the text.
Right.
And we've had years to kind of salivate over. Like, if it's misdirection, fine. You know, any normal situation, the misdirection wouldn't have lasted for 6-7 years. It would have been, you know, you'd have gotten the next movie or the next book or the next show. It's just...
And if you don't see the fun in this speculation
and
the building of the hype, then I feel sorry for you.
Oh!
Like, there's a lot of fun to be had there, and if you don't want to participate in it, fine, but you don't have to shit on the people who do.
I think there's a fair amount of fun in hype slang, too. Just being able to chuckle and say, you fools.
That's apparently the fun he's engaged in, because he is hype slaying.
Jim coming out swinging on the hype slayer.
Sorry, got to.
Kristen from Honolulu, do you think Dany will be upset with Tyrion after hearing about from Grey Worm and Missandei about his summit, quote-unquote, with the Masters? His approach to me has always been my way, or her approach, rather, has always been my way or the highway, and here comes Tyrion making strategic, albeit misguided, diplomatic moves. I figure she'll just dragon blast all the Masters, but after that, what will become of Tyrion, who doesn't have his buddy Varys anymore, and will she still trust him? Her children, Rhaegal and Viserion, seem to like him, so maybe?
That's a good question. I don't think Dany's going to like the events that transpired while she was gone.
And you can't trust Dany to be level-headed, either.
No. No, she's very vengeful.
I mean, Tyrion
in a lot
can
of
say,
situations.
You were gone. The city was tearing itself apart. What was I supposed to do? But then she could say, you break the fucking wheel and kill him. I mean, you never
right,
know.
And you fucked it all up. Now, look at the result of it.
What do you do if Dany kills Tyrion?
I cry. I like Tyrion. I like Tyrion a lot.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be a real shame.
Yep. He'll never get to have his impish delight.
No.
His imp's delight. Boy, you know, now that I say it that way, like, it feels like maybe they are setting him on a trajectory where he's mourning the things he's lost and will never have. Like, from a certain point of view, this feels like a coda of sorts.
Could be.
Oh, boy.
Do you think Tyrion's going to make it through?
Man, like, I don't know.
The whole series is what I'm talking about.
I know. Okay. I know. And I don't know. I've asked myself that question many a times. I don't think he's absolute. I struggle to figure out. Anyone is absolutely safe. I guess if I had to lay odds, I'd say Jon or Dany is going to survive.
That feels right.
Maybe both, but like both of them dying doesn't seem right. Tyrion, but other than that, like, I don't, I mean, I've always thought Arya would be one of the survivors because she's young enough to be, I mean, all, I guess all the main characters, the distinguishing thing about them is they are young. They're all young and they're of these summer children that were born. They don't know the winter and now winter's coming and the old people fuck things up and then they, I don't know, but yeah, Tyrion, I don't know. It'd be definitely, it's going to be an interesting moment on the internet if and when he dies. Nate D. Also, here's the other thing. Like, I know there's been a lot of book readers bemoaning the fact that, you know, the show advancing beyond the books are going to reverse spoil them now. And there's been a lot to talk. And, and surprisingly, little of that going down this season.
Yeah.
But holy shit, everyone that's a show-only watcher, strap, if the Winds of Winter comes out in the off-season and something like Tyrion dying happens, you will be hard-pressed to avoid it. I feel sorry for anyone that wants to be unsplit as a show watcher, because there's no way every one of these book readers are going to be respectful,
no.
And the BuzzFeed authors are going to be respectful, and the people on Facebook, like, it's going to be a goddamn catastrophe. And I would lay pretty good odds that it'll come out before next season. That's me being an idiot again.
Right.
Nate D. says, we learned this week that the brothers of that banners know winter is coming and want to do something about it. Could you take a moment to break down and remind us who is knowledgeable and who cares that the White Walkers are on the move and the winter is coming versus who is blissfully ignorant that winter is coming and the White Walkers are on the march south?
It feels like at this point it's just the people in the north and... maybe not even Ramsay.
I was going to say, not even the North. I think that the people with Jon are woke. And I think that maybe some of the sympathetic people, you know, obviously they're following Jon, are aware. The Brother of the Banners was honestly a true surprise.
It was, yeah.
I would be surprised if at the end Dany's contingent is ignorant. Although she could just come to Westeros just cause.
Yeah.
I mean, she's supposed to. Yeah, it's really like just everyone in the South seems like they're in open disbelief if you even bring up the subject.
What about Littlefinger? You think he knows?
I was just about to say Littlefinger and Varys. Littlefinger more than Varys.
Yeah.
Seems like he would have some inside info on that.
Yeah.
But then again, it's also part of his plot that, you know, him trying to climb. I could see it being thematically interesting for him to be trying to climb this ladder of chaos and something even beyond his. Like, he's fully accounted for every piece on the board except for what's beyond the wall, because he's never considered it.
Yeah. Or he's using this as an opportunity, maybe. I don't know.
I will say that if anyone could make use of the opportunity, it'd be Littlefinger, but yeah. I do question whether he's even considered that possibility.
If he knows about it, he certainly hasn't told anyone that he knows about it.
Sure.
So we are not sure.
Rebecca D. Arya was unsupervised in that hall of faces again. She had to take in at least one face because she needed to clear a space for the waif.
She's
I wonder what face
faces.
She took and what she'll do with it or them.
There's
got to be blank spaces on the wall.
Right. You like, don't build a new pillar for every face.
It did seem conspicuous that that didn't feel like a, you know, a half-filled pillar.
Yeah.
But, and there's the other thing. So, like, this show's kind of driving me nuts on this. And this is why I say, like, I can't believe 2 years into this, we still don't know the rules. Because Jack, when he drank the poison, it took on the face of Arya, who's still alive. Now, you could be saying, well, that's just Arya tripping balls, but I could just as easily argue that no, because her eyes hadn't got blurry and the poison hadn't kicked in yet. So I don't really know. Can Arya, if she takes a face, can she just put it on? Can she put on a face without needing one? Like, that's...
I don't know.
It's just inconsistent.
Or not well explained.
Unless you say that, like, okay, she's just tripping balls, and then I guess you'd need a face to turn into a face. And
sure.
Turn into someone having a face. I don't know. I don't know, but it's interesting. I will say that I am fully prepared for her to do some face switching later on and for it to be completely unexplained because the Double D's feeling like they've laid enough groundwork that they don't need to explain it.
She's never done it.
She's never done it.
I think for her to get trained in the way of the Faceless Men and never change faces would be a big mistake.
Yeah, no kidding. And I'm just like, if you introduce someone that's brought back to life and you don't use it later on, it'd be, I feel like the same thing. And I do feel like there's going to be a lot of people today and like, this isn't the way Faceless Men work, but I'll be there to say,
How do you know?
How do you know? Where's the book? Where's the manual? Because we sure as fuck haven't gotten it.
Yeah.
Dan C., if Cersei goes before the court and admits her affair with Jaime, then that admission strips Tommen of his title as king. The High Septon has to know this is a possibility.
Oh, taste that dry pie.
It might even have been his plan all along. I want to see if there's actually this comes of anything. With Tommen adding the faith as one of the two pillars, take out the crown and the yep, looks like we just
made
some dry pie. Just goes to show that Tommen is clueless on how to play the Game of Thrones and he's just a child being played on all sides. Yep. Very, very, very true. D, just D, plain old D. A pity for Essos and Westeros medicine that the actress was killed. Her surgical skills could have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in the upcoming wars. Not just stitching up flesh, but stomach, intestines, maybe liver, pancreas, or kidneys, too. And no infections. Truly, the Florence Nightingale of that epic was lost. That is who we should be mourning.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
About these plays. I can tell you want to say something about this email.
No, I was just saying it because it made me laugh.
Oh, okay.
Good way to get read if you made me laugh. Like, if you made me laugh on first read.
Right.
But don't try, because that's also, some people get angry. It's like, I made a funny dick joke and you didn't read it. Well, I had 100 dick jokes and
I chose the
best. I like
best
to make
one.
My own.
Oh, that too, yeah. What is Tyrion's reputation in Essos? And specifically in Meereen, because I know he obviously has a reputation given these plays.
In Braavos. Sure.
How far has that spread? And is he actually the most famous dwarf in the city? Like, do people recognize him as he walks through the streets?
I would think so.
So they obviously don't care that he's a murderer and a betrayer and, like...
Well, he's their murderer and betrayer.
The worst of all things.
The thing is, Braavos is what they call a free city. As opposed to Slaver's Bay, so there might be kind of like a north-south kind of, and I'm speaking of like in American terms, not in Westerosi terms,
right?
Like kind of like, well, that's what they say in Braavos, but of course they would,
huh? Okay.
Because they're just like a different way of life, and you know, this guy's associated with Dany, and the Red Priestesses are saying that I thought it was interesting they're working in that like as long as we remain faithful to the Queen and her advisors, then we'll never be put in chains again. Pretty strong incentive to not believe any foreign propaganda.
Okay.
Because that's the thing. Like, anything coming from Westeros and Braavos is going to be seen not as like, oh, this is Essos, so it's good. It's just still being seen as foreign propaganda.
Right, but it seems to be hitting with the crowds in Braavos.
And
right?
I do think that's very interesting that Tyrion is getting this reputation as a monster elsewhere in the world where he's also a savior. Like, I think that will probably work again. I mean, that it seems like there's a lot of things that could go wrong with Dany going to Westeros. She's bringing the Dothraki. She's bringing a wanted murderer and Kinslayer, which is true, and an accused Kingslayer, which is false.
Yeah.
And... you know, the spider and disgraced Westerosi slave trader knight. Like, there's a lot of things in her entourage that's baggage for days, man.
Mm-hmm.
Baggage for days. I mean, just imagine the political attack ads that they could make on her.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's no good.
Kevin EW says, do we know if the Faceless Men are technically dead or alive? This is an interesting take, and I want to talk about it a little bit because I'm going to take this pretty seriously. Is it possible that Arya was already quote-unquote dead or can not be killed before she was stabbed by the Waif? There are three reasons why I believe she's already a faceless man and cannot be killed. If you recall in Season 5, Episode 10, after Jaqen drank the poison to pay for Meryn Trant's life, Arya pulled the faces off of Jaqen and saw her own. Arya drank from the fountain, which resulted in death for the people, as we've seen in previous episodes. In this episode, Jaqen said that Arya was no one before he let her go. So this theory is that ultimately you're going to find out the Faceless Men are all dead.
Why would Jaqen send Waif to kill someone who's dead?
That is a very good question, and that's the only flaw I see in the argument. I guess that implies that, like, I think Jon
could be killed again, certainly.
Could be killed again, certainly.
I mean, Boros was, or whatever his name is. Thoros.
Right. Even though he still has, like, when he even got resurrected, he still had these giant slashes in his heart. And, I mean, I'm just assuming that he can still be killed. So, like, if you cut off someone's head, that would still kill them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that tends to kind of work with the literary terms of immortality. Like, you're going to be proof of poison, and you can't be stabbed to death. But if you cut off your head or something like that, it's bad news. That would be an interesting reveal that would make all this shit make sense. The Arya couldn't die from the stab wounds. This was just all a big game and a test. And to get her to open her eyes to accept the reality of her situation. That she still fully hasn't. And maybe that's what Jake and Smirk is about. That, like, oh, you're no one, but you don't know what that means. Now, I will say that even though I'm taking this seriously and I'm considering it, I still think it's probably bullshit. But it is something that would make a lot of things in retrospect make sense.
I guess. I just don't know why Jaqen knowing that would try to have her killed.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like I said, it doesn't explain everything, but I do think there is a way that this could be revealed that would be... Hmm. And also, you know, it would be yet another Stark is undead.
Sure.
All you gotta do is put Sansa, you have her dead and flipped back to life. I mean, we've got Melisandre fallen, why not? Have all the Stark children, remaining Stark children are dead. Then you can bring back all their direwolves, and everybody can be happy.
Yeah, bring back Ned, why not? Just sew that head back on, get Lady Crane to do it. Bring her back, get her to sew the head back on.
Shit, she's got a full articulated skeleton, and that's more than she needs.
Easily.
Sarah A.B. said, "While I totally see your frustration around Arya's apparent fatal wounds and her ability to outrun an incredibly fast waif, I think you're missing some of the mysticism in the show. I think royal blood counts for a lot in this show, or king's blood, as it's referred to. Because Arya is a Stark, I think she may be stronger than most other children. All the characters that escape have indeed had some trait that make them more likely to survive incredible feats. The Hound as a warrior, Jon Snow also has royal blood, etc. Bottom line, Arya is a badass Stark, so it'll take more to kill her." What do you think about this royal blood argument? If some point... Someone says, "Boy, you Starks are hard to kill." Well, it's because you're royal blood.
What about Robert Baratheon?
Yeah, that's true. But that boar fucked him up pretty good.
Yeah.
With some gut wounds.
Exactly.
That got septic and died despite all the milk of poppy. And, yeah.
Now, he was out of shape and kind of old, but I don't know. It's just, like I said before, it's another bandage on a thing that just doesn't work. As presented on screen.
Plus, also if you want to, I'm going to do a devil's advocate. Robert Baratheon was never really the king. He was an upstart rebel. Like, Targaryens are kings. Starks were kings up until 300 years ago. Like, they literally no shit had royal blood. Robert Baratheon was an offshoot of the Targaryens. Like, you know, it's not nearly as close to the source. I don't believe that, but I'm trying
to... I feel like these are all just bandages on the story as they're trying to tell it. Yeah. Yeah. They're all just stitches in a Lady Crane manifesto. I don't know.
Okay. Jeremy from Australia said, "Couldn't we have gotten at least a one-liner from the Lannister guard, such as, 'The Blackfish is dead, but boy, he killed 30 of our men.' This would at least given us an idea of how badass he was."
Nope. I think he just floundered.
Yeah.
No pun intended. Boy, he just flopped like a fish on land.
Fish out of water. I don't like it, but all evidence seems to point to the fact that he just did a
he thought
last
he was going
stand
to.
That did nothing.
Yeah.
Although we didn't see him die.
Mm-hmm.
Sue in Seattle says, "I know you're bummed about how Arya's story played out in Braavos, but think about what awesomeness could remain for her. This is the sunny side and the essentially nothing's changed side of the theory.
Yeah.
How does she fit into Game of Thrones endgame? Given her specialized skill set as an assassin, I don't see her being the person who brings down the Night's King on the battlefield. Walder Frey, though, should be easy target, because the Freys are idiots. But what other major characters is she destined to kill? Could it be the Mountain and then on to Cersei? Or, God forbid, if Dany ends up the villain, might Arya be the only person who can get around her protection?"
Oh, I think the names on her list are all in danger at this point, yeah. She's going to be pissed and ready to go.
Yep. That's the thing. Like, I don't... To the extent that 10 people's speculation on what Arya could do in a plot is not interesting, I don't know that mine is more interesting than that.
Yeah, it's an open-ended question at this point.
Yeah.
Like, she can go back. All we know is she's headed back to Westeros, and that's it.
Yeah.
And now she has
And if I had a good
skills.
Idea, I wouldn't be shy about sharing it, but it's like I'm not a box with a button that says push here for speculation.
No, the most obvious thing is her list.
Yeah.
That's where
maybe
she's
the spoiler section,
headed.
And not because it's a spoiler, just because it's in the quickest next podcast. We could go over her list and who's still left, because a lot of them been cleared out.
A lot of the ones she mentioned, like Cersei, the Mountain. Who else did you mention?
Well, the Hound was mentioned, but didn't she mention that he's really no longer on the list? Ilan Payne was always a big one.
Right, yeah.
Who the actor got throat cancer. I guess he recovered, but they rewrote his part in the story to essentially be Bronn, so I don't feel like he... Plus, who cares? Like, has he been a part of the show since season one?
Not that I remember.
Like, he did swing the sword to cut off Ned's head... So, yeah, but I don't know that it would even land five seasons later. So,
yeah.
It might be an interesting idea to go over her list. And I think the book list might be a little bit different, so there's the justification for putting it into spoiler edition. But we could go through, like, all the peoples whose names are still on there and out there and see if there's any interesting possibilities. But it seems like you're right. Cersei, the Mountain, those are the interesting ones.
Yeah.
I would like to see Arya and the Hound meet up again.
Okay.
Because I don't think she'd kill him, but I think that they were always one of the more entertaining pairings with Arya anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Andy K from LA said, "Hey guys, I'm on my second read through of the books, and there's so much that I'm picking up on the reread that I didn't catch the first time. Relax, there's no real spoilers, it's just some insight that I thought was cool. There's been a lot of fans predicting big character deaths, especially since we're approaching the end of the saga. The Arya storyline has been frustrating and confusing for many of us, especially after recent episodes. But one thing I thought was interesting, reading Arya's will she or won't she survive the series questions, or regarding, rather, was this passage from the first book, Game of Thrones, Arya's first ever POV chapter that foreshadows current and future events. Jon Snow is talking with Arya at Winterfell after she had just run crying out of the proper ladies' stitching lessons with Septa Mordaine, Sansa, and Myrcella. Jon Snow says to Arya, "The longer you hide, the sterner the penance. You'll be sewing all through winter. When spring thaw comes, you will find your body with a needle still locked tight between your frozen fingers." Arya didn't think that was funny. "I hate needlework," she said with a passion, "and it's not fair. To me, this seems like Arya will make it back to Westeros, but pay with her life somehow after the Cold Wars to come. She'll live through the winter, or next book, or next season, but will die with her sword in a final act. What do you think?"
Some interesting foreshadowing.
Yeah, especially with the whole needle locked tight between your frozen fingers.
Yeah.
I don't know. That has a certain condemnatory ring to it.
Yeah, it feels kind of right, too. I don't know.
So anyway, I hope people don't. Do you think people consider that a spoiler?
It's
a little bit of book foreshadowing. Now I'm second guessing myself. Yeah, but it wasn't mentioned in the book. I mean, there's generic bitching that she doesn't like needlework and blah, 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 but...
Right.
I don't think John said that in the show. Anyway, maybe we'll cut it later. Who knows? We'll see. That's all the feedback we got. That's how we end things. We will be back Friday with the full spoiler edition. Also, a little bit of quirk to our scheduling that people might not know is that we record that early Thursday.
Yeah.
Just to give us time to, or not early, like mid-afternoon Thursday, to give us time to edit it and whatnot, so we can release it early on Friday morning. So I think a lot of people get bummed out when they have a really hot take that doesn't make it in. Sometimes if you send it in on Thursday, it's not going to make it in. So I just want to alert people to that. You know, I know there's a lot of frustration in the feedback in general, but that's the way it works. But we'll be back Friday with the spoiler edition. Where I'm not actually, usually I've had a pretty good topic in mind to talk about, but I felt like this episode, what we'll be talking about is stuff that maybe we were hoping to get and is going to be dead now, primarily. But if you got any hot takes, send it into Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. Of course, on our forums, forums.baldmove.com, if you want to discuss stuff, spoiler or non-spoiler, with your fellow fans. Make sure you clearly mark it. And we'll be back Friday and then Sunday for the Battle of the Bastards.
Can't wait.
See if we can pull out of this steep nosedive Bravo's put us in.
Prediction, which bastard wins? Assuming it's a Ramsay John.
Jon Snow wins or I riot.
Okay.
It might be just me as a one man, but, you know.
Like, you bring Jon back just lose?
I'll flip every table in this room.
Okay. There's only one, and I'm sitting across from it, so I'm worried.
Yeah. I'm not going to get to eat many chickens this season, but I will flip every fucking table. So it better be Jon.
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, cool. Well, we will see everybody on Friday who wants to tune in. And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.